And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here. Tonight on the big program, we're going to be talking about the More Jobs Governor. Yes, our governor here in Pennsylvania, the More Jobs Governor, Governor Tom Corbett. His approval rating's not so good. I think, you know, when you don't do anything, when you spend more time in Latin America, when you spend more time in Washington and Chicago than you do in Harrisburg, might kind of have something to do with that. When you spend more time doing whatever it is that he does, instead of promoting jobs, instead of actually standing up for the state, instead of funding education, instead of a lot of things, what generally happens is your approval tanks. We'll talk about that. Also going to talk about education. The Harrisburg recovery officer has come up with his proposal. We talked a little bit about it on Friday, the big plan. What's the plan going to mean? What's it going to do? We're going to talk with one of the Harrisburg School District's board members about this plan that, as I understand, 30 days to approve, or someone will be appointed to make sure that it does. So we got a lot to talk about tonight. Also, got your ideas, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. So this afternoon, I spent a good portion of our day in Hershey, the Pennsylvania Conference of Teamsters in town. You know, being formerly a Teamster 20 years, I was a card-carrying member. It's good to see folks who are, you know, fighting the fight, standing up and defending the middle class, defending workers in this country. I mean, I'm often taken back by the work that these guys do representing their members and their fellow workers, because they're workers just like the rest of us. But in having these conversations, you know, you realize that the no rights at work agenda, the Corbetts of the world and the Republicans of the world are harming real people every day. And, you know, we get into a lot of this sterile talk about, well, you know, this piece of legislation, well, it's not going to hurt anybody. It's going to make us more efficient. And we keep hearing this about prevailing wage. Oh, well, you know, that's going to make government more whatever. I saw an article over the weekend. It's going to make them more productive. How is cheating workers out of wages going to make government more efficient and productive? Explain that to me, because I'm missing something. And all of these arguments that we keep seeing the right making, that, you know, stealing wages, destroying benefits, destroying working conditions, how is that going to benefit us as a society? So it was, and hats off to the guys that I spoke to today. We'll be back tomorrow. I'm going to give a little speech, little couple of words. Because look, you know, this whole no rights at work agenda, all of the things we've been talking about over the last couple of years that have gone on in Wisconsin and that went on in Michigan and places, Maine, Ohio, you name it, they're coming here. The moneyed interests are coming here. The infrastructure is being built. The whole no rights at work agenda is coming here. And in talking with these folks, they're keenly aware of what's going on. And look, they understand. The bullseye is on the back of all working people, not just them. They're going to be the first affected by it, yes. But we're all going to go down. We're all going to lose as they pursue this. And, you know, I had an opportunity to meet Treasury Secretary Rob McCord, who claimed, you know, if he was a betting man, that he would bet that he was going to run for governor. And I don't think anybody in the room was surprised. I don't think anybody who hears that is surprised. I think he's just, you know, waiting it out, you know, letting to see where the field goes. And we'll talk a little bit about Corbett's run against any of them. But, you know, at the end of the day, you know, here's a guy I got to spend a good 15 minutes with talking about, you know, where he sees the state going, what he sees is important. And it's really jobs. It's, you know, it's the things that, you know, we do for ourselves. It's the things we do for each other. It's that stuff. And, you know, all of this handouts to big corporations, all of this, there's some questions. But at the end of the day, it comes down to we need to be talking to each other. We need to. Here's what worries me. 2014 is just around the corner. We see another 4 years of Governor Corbett. What we will see is more handouts for businesses, not local business, not your mom and pops, not your local, you know, your local chamber of commerce types, big multi-state, multinational corporations who are using Pennsylvania's tax dollars to destroy working conditions somewhere else. And to me, that's the problem. This whole race to the bottom, this whole pitting one state against each other. And I know, I hear it a lot. You're just afraid of competition. No, I welcome honest competition. But competition based on my children having less educational opportunities, competition based on stealing as much as we can from seniors and low-wage workers to entice other companies to come here, I just don't think that's the right level field to be playing on. Sorry, just don't. So we've got a lot to talk about, and over the next year and a half, next 18 months, it's going to be a very interesting election, because it is really the future of our Commonwealth and the direction that we're going to go. Pretty simple stuff. But while I was in Hershey, you know, we broke for lunch, and we ended up going to one of my favorite restaurants, you know, because it has one of the things that I will eat, because I'm told I'm a fairly picky eater. I'm told that, you know, there are a lot of things that I won't eat, so things have to be in such a way. But the waitress who served us, I couldn't help, and it's one of those things, I'm sorry, I just couldn't help myself. We sat down at the table, and it's a chain restaurant. The one I go to where I live doesn't have these, but this one had a pretty sizable bar area. And on the table in the bar area was a little screen that you could move around, and I guess it was wireless, and you could punch in if you wanted a drink or if you wanted appetizers or if you wanted to order something. And they would just bring it to you. And it, you know, seems like a pretty decent idea, I guess, if you're the one owning the business. Because, hey, I can get rid of workers. I can lower my labor costs and make my customers, you know, happy, because I don't have to have more servers. I can have less, but still have a high level of customer service. So I asked the waitress, I said, you know, what do you think of these things? She's like, oh, well, you know, I'm not all that worried about it. You know, they don't work half the time. You know, so it's no big deal. You know, by the way, you know, they're still going to have us come and do all this stuff. And I was struck by the fact that, you know, she didn't view that in front of her as her job, as her being automated out of a job. You know, I'm sitting there looking at them going, this is the end of you. They're going to have that, because she didn't bring my food out. She just came and took my order. Somebody else from the kitchen came and brought it out, because that was his job. So what happens to her? And then I started thinking about it. Okay, well, you know, we've eliminated her. She's done. We're now doing her job by punching it into the computer. We're now doing her job by placing our order ourselves. Do we have to leave a tip at the end? And if so, who gets the tip money? I mean, because all of this stuff kind of gets me thinking. Yeah, because, you know, I remember talk when I was growing up of how machines were going to do all the work. And eventually, you know, manufacturing and everything would be done by machines. Automation would be everywhere. And we wouldn't have to do anything. It would all be done for us. Because, you know, they don't need food. They don't need oxygen. They don't need anything. They don't need sleep. They can run constantly. I had an interesting conversation with a history professor friend of mine who said, you know, and I remember these stories. He said, you know, back in the 50s and 60s, they were talking about when automation takes over, when they automate all of the manufacturing and all the jobs, you know, going down to a 24-hour work week. And it made me start thinking, because there's a lot of talk of how we save manufacturing in this country. There's a lot of talk about bringing back those high-paying manufacturing jobs that were, for at least a generation, possibly two, were heavily unionized jobs that supported a family, that, you know, supported upward mobility. The kids got to go to college. You took out a vacation every now and again. And it was great, because as you did more work, as productivity went up, your wages went up. And then right around 1980, that stopped. Productivity continued to go up. Wages stagnated and even declined. If you look at manufacturing output since the end of World War II, output in manufacturing, the productivity, has increased over 700%. In fact, in 2010, manufacturing accounted for about $2 trillion of our economy. That's the highest ever, dollar-wise. And you go, wow, that must be great because, you know, hey, some of that gets passed on, right? More jobs. Well, in 2010, there were 11.7 million manufacturing jobs in the U.S. The lowest number of manufacturing, of producing jobs since the end of World War II. In 1948, at the end of World War II, you had over 14 million manufacturing jobs. And you had a population that was considerably smaller. What, less, maybe a third of the size? But here we are, less manufacturing jobs, productivity off the charts. In 1980, that number of employees had peaked at nearly 20 million. So you go back to what we've been talking about the last several months. Profits as a percentage of GDP, never higher. Wages, never lower. Number of jobs, never lower. Somebody's benefiting from this massive productivity gain, and it's not the working people. And this is what I've been saying for the longest time. Look, understand, automation has killed millions of jobs. And to make the argument, well, those hard-paying unions, they forced them out. No. A dollar an hour is still too much if you can get a machine to do it for less. Globalization also killed a lot of jobs. If you can get someone in China to do it for 25 or 30 or 50 cents an hour, that's where you're going. And for me, the conversation has to have, what kind of an economy do we see coming down the road? If everything's going to be automated, because we're talking about reviving manufacturing in the U.S., which I'm in favor of. I'm all in favor of making stuff. The problem is, okay, who's going to make it? Is it more automation? Are we going to give huge tax breaks to companies to completely automate their factories so there are no people in them? But we're making stuff. It's made in the U.S. Well, maybe so, but how is it benefiting us as a society if no one can afford to buy those products? If no one can be active in the economy, how's that good for us? You know, I was thinking about this, you know, on the way home today, and you've got this jobs picture. You know, something happened in 1980. Ronald Reagan took over, and we pursued this neoliberal agenda. We pursued this agenda that business is always right, and we need more. We need more business, and we need to be more business friendly. So you had all these jobs that have gone away, been eviscerated. Automation's one of them, but globalization's the other. These insane free trade agreements, and this next one coming up, the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement, all bad for you and me. And manufacturing as part of the economy, never better. Almost $2 trillion of our economy is in manufacturing. We, you and me, we're not getting that. That's all fruit for the top. So my question is how do we make sure that workers, you and me and the people who need these jobs to survive, how do you get a piece of that? That's the million-dollar question. And it's something that, you know, we may not be in manufacturing, we may be in something else, but it's got to pay a decent living wage, and it's got to be something that we can support a family on. It's that simple. Going to take a quick break. When we come back, going to talk about the Harrisburg situation with their school district. Just insanity. Quick break, right back.
Intelligent conversation with a heart. The voice of the working class. Rick Smith.
Here's today's headlines from Workers Independent News. I'm Jesse Russell. Sunday was Workers Memorial Day, an annual day intended to reflect on preventable deaths and injuries due to a failure to implement suitable workplace safeguards. While the day is primarily recognized in Canada and the United States, this year there was a heavy focus on the unfolding tragedy in Bangladesh. On Saturday, 23 workers were pulled out of the ruins of a Bangladeshi garment factory that collapsed early last week. An estimated 900 people are still missing, with at least 340 confirmed deaths. The collapse has once again put an international spotlight on the poor working conditions and inefficient building standards in the South Asian country. According to Al Jazeera, police have arrested two engineers who approved the building construction and two owners of New Wave Apparels Limited. Bangladeshi officials told the news agency that the top three floors of the eight-story building were constructed illegally. Workers had protested going to work in the days leading up to the collapse due to cracks appearing in the walls of the factory complex. However, management ordered workers to enter the building and work or else lose wages. The collapse has also brought attention to the reluctance of Western corporations that do business in Bangladesh to enforce safety standards on contractors. In 2011, the National Garment Workers Federation in Bangladesh presented a proposal to retailers that would have helped improve safety standards. According to the Associated Press, those companies rejected the proposals and instead pledged to self-audit. Among the companies rejecting the proposal were H&M, Walmart, and Gap. Since that 2011 proposal was first rejected, incidents at Bangladesh's garment factories have not declined. In November of 2012, a factory fire took the lives of 112 workers. An investigation into that fire revealed that management had locked the doors, so workers couldn't leave, and thereby trapped the workers in the inferno. It had echoes of the 1911 Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire in New York City, which led to reforms in safety standards in the United States. In contrast, while labor organizations in Bangladesh renewed their push for reforms after the 2012 fire, the multinational companies continued to resist. In the 5 months since that deadly fire, the AFL-CIO has documented at least 40 additional incidents in Bangladesh, resulting in at least 9 deaths and more than 600 injuries.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News.
Every now and then I visit an elementary school. Talking with children is a pretty good idea, I think. They ask questions we don't think about, and they ask them very directly. Recently, a little girl wanted to know, what's the hardest part of your job? That got me thinking. I looked down and I told her, the hardest part is telling people no.
I thought he was going to say the hardest part of my job is finding my office. You know, you're in Chicago, you're in Latin America, you're in D.C. I guess the hardest part of his job is finding where he actually works. Just a thought. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. So we hear a lot about funding education. We got a governor 2 years in a row cut $1 billion from K-12 education. Well, the good folks in the Denver, Colorado area, I think they have figured it out. They figured it out. No more selling wrapping paper. No more selling, you know, cookies. No more candles. No more candy. No more of that. No more of those long, arduous fundraising campaigns that basically bring almost nothing in but cause an awful lot of work. No, going to do away with that. What they have come up with is Totally Tennytown. And I guess Totally Tennytown in this area in northwestern Denver represents about 14 schools up and down this corridor called Tenson Street. What'd they do? They decided no more of that fundraising stuff. We're going to have a pub crawl for education. And, you know, what better way to, here in Pennsylvania, you got a governor who wants to sell the liquor stores for education. These people are just going to go right to the bars, get liquored up, and fund education. That's a great idea. Maybe we should fund everything like that. Get people liquored up and steal their money. Anyway, last Friday, the Harrisburg School District's Chief Recovery Officer, Gene Vino, presented his financial recovery plan for folks to look at, and I'm generally skeptical of these kind of take it or leave it, or we're going to impose our will on proposals, which is why I've asked Harrisburg School Board member Brandon Murray to come talk with us about the proposal. Brandon, thanks for taking time for me.
Well, thanks for having me again, Rick.
You know, so I look at this proposal dropped on Friday, and as I've read this, before we get into the details, this is a situation where you have to adopt this plan the next 30 days, or you're going to lose, what is it, $6.4 million in interest-free loans?
That's correct. We do have wiggle room to maneuver the numbers around within the plan if we don't agree with some of the things. And that's one of the aspects that the administration is looking at now, to see with attrition and with how many teachers might leave due to the plan itself, what we might be doing, you know, to maneuver the numbers around to make it more feasible for our district.
So, and if this doesn't happen, what happens if you don't do it in 30 days? What happens?
Well, I mean, we still have a year from December to really adopt the plan. Now, if any point in time we just vote on it and vote no, then of course, then the state can come in, and they can, it'll go to the courts on whether or not that they will allow a receiver to come in and take over the school district.
So we could have the school district taken over with someone like that's taken over the Harrisburg City. Then.
Yeah, and one of the real weird parts to this whole situation is that as long as our city is under Act 47, this school district will be underneath or could ask for the help from the CFO, our CFO. So the chief recovery officer could be here, or CRO, I apologize, for as long as we supposedly would need him. So it is kind of a tricky situation. Now, he states that that's only for the benefit of the school district. I tend to differ on that situation and in that opinion. But
so where do you come down on this? I mean, I'm sure you've looked at it. I'm sure you've studied this. You know, I've seen some things in it that are concerning. I'm curious where you see the school board coming down and yourself coming down on this.
Well, I mean, it's very, very difficult, Rick. I mean, I've never voted, you know, on something without, you know, putting my conscience into it.
Right.
However, a lot of the different things that are involved with this are, I think there's a lot that actually you could say that is good.
Yeah.
There are quite a few things that I don't like about it. I'll go over the things that I do like real quickly. First of all, the measurements for our academics. It's fine time that the Harrisburg School District has to live up to the expectations of the taxpayers and the residents of the district to make sure that we're A, graduating more students, B, getting better academic numbers. That's a big part to what I see as a huge plus to it. The other thing is that they do put some effort into getting parent involvement.
Right.
And that's a huge aspect to what we've been trying to accomplish in the district with a couple different of the aspects of the student improvement grant. Now, where I don't really stay on the same line is that we need to have a different wording for this person who they want to bring in as the CEO. We had a meeting tonight that was closed door to talk about personnel, and I made it pretty clear that the wording for a CEO in a school district is just bad terminology. You're leaving yourself open to too many people interpreting that as, you know, someone from the banks coming in and just doing whatever they want. Now, we've got to look at it as a different aspect. Mr. Vino has stated that he wants the person to come in to do the day-to-day operations. It's really implement a lot of the different financial aspects that we do need in the school district, which I do believe there is some things that are merited by having someone come in, but a level of responsibility given to that person cannot be more than the superintendent. And if that's the case there, or if they're on the same level as the superintendent, why are we not looking for a new superintendent to take the place of the one that we have that can do our finances in a better situation?
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that because I think, now you guys have had a number of superintendents over the last couple of years, and I'm of the mindset, you know, why can't we get somebody who's going to stay for one and going to actually do a much better job than I've seen the last couple? Because I understand.
It's upsetting, you know, to be honest with you, to see how many in the last, you know, in every single one of the superintendents from Harrisburg for the past few of them have been fired. Whether that was wrongful or not, you know, in case of Gerald Cohn, there's still, you know, there was litigation about this. So, you know, not to get into the details too much about that specifically, but, you know, it hasn't had a really good track record for getting the best personnel in the best situations. But, yeah. You know, I do believe that over the course of time, you know, time will tell exactly what's going on. I know that our superintendent now did quite a bit on her plate when she walked into the position, especially with everything that was going on with that litigation over the last superintendent. But I don't want to throw everything at her feet and say that this was, you know, her fault in general, but also think about the state taking over for 10 years, giving us about 2.5 years to say, okay, we'll right the ship, and then saying, you know, maybe you didn't do such a good job. Maybe we should have someone else come in and take a look now. So it seems like we're never given the opportunity to really get everything back on track before they bring someone else in.
Right. You know, when I look at this, and I read through some of the report, and I didn't find the word poverty in there in the sense. You've got to deal with the poverty issues of the community. To me, this is a much bigger problem than just, you know, what we can raise taxes 3.5%, or we can cut workers' wages, and we can close buildings and do these things. At the end of the day, if kids are coming to school hungry, if kids aren't getting the reinforcement at home, to me, that's an integral part of it. And I like the fact, and you hit on it, that they're asking for more parental involvement. But there's got to be something more than just asking. I mean, you've really got to get out into the community and pull people in.
Absolutely. And, I mean, that's one of the reasons why, you know, a while back I was pushing for the mentor program, more mentor programs in the school district involving the Big Brothers Big Sisters program, because that's not going to cost the school district a dime. You know, and look outside the box. You know, I know so many people hate that terminology, but to be honest with you, with the school district that I've been a part of now for quite a while and I'm proud to represent, there are so many avenues that we really need to channel. I understand the businesses in the community have not done their fair share when it comes down to specific aspects of things. Now, don't get me wrong. I think that there are quite a few businesses in the city that have given, though they call it a pilot program, it's pay in lieu of taxes. And they've done their part. Pinnacle is one of them that has given some money into our school district without being asked. Now, we need that buy-in from other businesses in the school district. And we also, to be honest with you, need to look at reforming the way education is paid for, especially in a city where half the city cannot be taxed due to state, you know, and nonprofits
yep.
that take up all that property.
Yeah, you know, and for me, why does Pennsylvania need 500 school districts? I mean, you know, at some point, the way we fund education, the way we've divided things up based on property boundaries, and to me, it's a system that's set up so that places like Harrisburg, places, you know, like inner city Philadelphia or inner city Pittsburgh, that they're starved of resources, and you end up with a situation much like you're talking about right now here in Harrisburg, where the money's not there. You're talking about taking it in wages from the workers. You're talking about taking it in opportunity for students, closing schools, selling assets off. It seems to me to be, well, the recipe for disaster, and part of me believes it was planned that way.
You know, it definitely leaves it up to a cynical person to definitely think in that aspect. I absolutely, you know, I can agree with you when it comes down to, you know, I've definitely, you know, been on your show before talking about for-profit industry and education is never a good situation, and I'll give you an example tonight. We were talking about something specific, and they brought up Wonder Bread and how they struck and how it didn't work out well, and they, you know, he wanted to, Mr. Vino wanted to think of it more of a Chrysler situation where this instead of the government, it was the state that's going to give us a no-interest loan that can right the ship. And I said, you know, to relate education to business, it's just a fallacy, because we're talking about a business that had a model that did not succeed, okay? And there was a lot of union jobs in both situations, but The only thing is that we're talking about the future of the state, the future of our America in education. We were talking about the future of automotive in any other aspect. You know, those two you cannot put aside. We're talking about the education system in general. Now, don't get me wrong. I think that we need to remodel the way the education is done. We haven't done any remodeling of education in over 120 years, and there's definitely merit to the fact that we need to look at it from a different perspective. But I mean, you can't tell me that, you know, these teachers who have not given a raise in 2 years, then you're going to ask them now to take a pay cut for the next 2 years. And maybe in the third year, we're going to even send them that money back. It's very, very difficult from a person who came from the coal mining region. You know, my great-grandfather, my grandfather, and, you know, and now I and my father were all in union. And, you know, we fought so hard to make sure that education and, you know, to get the funding that we get and to get the salary that they have. It's difficult for a person like me to sit back and say, well, yeah, okay, well, you know, then, you know, we'll just go along with this plan without having to see if there's anything that we can do to change it.
So is the answer, as this proposal points out, bringing in a dedicated grant writer to go out and beg for funds from foundations? Because, you know, I look at this whole push towards corporatizing education and begging for resources. And look, I understand this is well above your pay grade. This is a state issue. This is a federal government issue in how we fund education. But, you know, as our larger government entities have walked away from funding education, it's being left on the school boards across urban areas across this country who are struggling with the very same things that you are. But for me, the answer is not, you know, how we make teachers in your district suffer or how we close down schools. It's how we get Harrisburg and how we get Washington and how we get capitals across this country to say, you know what, we need to go and do what we did 20, 30, 50 years ago and actually fund this stuff so that we don't have to have bake sales for books and we don't have to have pub crawls to make sure the lights stay on or sell advertising on report cards, that we just fund education because it's vital to the commons of this nation.
And Rick, I'll give you an example of this. You know, I'm a longtime supporter of Barack Obama. I went down to visit with people from, you know, a bunch of different areas in Pennsylvania. We went down with a liberal group, and I went down to talk to them about funding education. And I spoke with an advisor to the Undersecretary of Education. His name was Mr. Rodriguez. And we spent maybe a half an hour in the room talking about how grant writing was the way to get itself out of it. Well, at the end of the whole situation, I looked at him and I said, well, sir, we can't afford a grant writer. What are we supposed to do? And he looked at me stunned that we couldn't, as a school district, get enough money together to get a grant writer.
But here's the thing. Look, if you don't have enough money to put in the classroom, how the hell are you going to get money for a grant writer? I'd rather you spend
exactly.
I'd rather you spend that $100,000 a year in the classroom.
Exactly.
And what happens if you don't get the grants? I mean, let's say you spend $100,000, and guess what? 100 other cities across this country are vying for the same grants. What happens if you don't get them?
I understand your point of view completely. We have to work within the parameters of what we have, Rick, unfortunately.
I
absolutely agree with you on funding education needs to be, I mean, to be honest with you, besides healthcare, I mean, I don't see anything else that is important to the future of the country is education. Between healthcare and education, those are the two that, you know, I feel are the absolute most important, because if you're not healthy, you can't go to school to begin with,
yep.
You know. And then secondly, if you're going to school and you're not, you know, and you're not healthy, you know, then you're going to get other kids sick and you're not going to learn. And then, possibly, you know, making sure that each kid has a warm meal, you know. So, I mean, these are the things that, and, you know, one of the things that we did focus on was the food services in here. And they didn't say that they were rolling it out, but they didn't say that they weren't going to roll it out, was just to shop out the food services. Now, I know, and you know, that anytime we get for-profit industry into anything like this, just like they did with the school buses, could end up costing us more money down the road.
Yep.
Because they're only there for a profit, and they're not there to, they're not necessarily there for the right, you know, for the right reasons.
And that's my problem with that whole part of it. But, you know, I look at this, and there are some things, like you said, there's some good, there are some things that I'm just not comfortable at all, the grant writing thing being one of them. But I saw a report on Friday, just hours after the report was released, or it was released to the media, I guess. I don't know when you got to see it. I don't know when your fellow board members got to see it. But I look at one of your fellow board members, Ms. Lawson, who said she thought it was a good plan. She said she was excited. She thinks it can work, and you know, she claims she's not always the most agreeable person, but she said that this plan is going to work. I'm curious, you know, what's the sentiment of the rest of the board? Not for you to go after fellow board members, but, you know, is this
I understand completely. I was kind of taken aback by Ms. Lawson's comments, considering the fact that we didn't receive the plan until 10:45 in the morning. When the press conference was at 11, she made that comment roughly at around 11:05. Didn't even look at the actual plan yet. So I was kind of taken aback by that. And I mean, to be honest with you, I mean, she can take this for what it's worth. You know, she hasn't been one to always be on the right side of things. You know, when it comes down to actually looking over things and showing up to meetings and doing what she needs to do as a board member, she hasn't always been there. So it's not shocking that she would automatically support the plan before having to actually look over it. I'm not exactly sure where she got her intel from, you know, that she could support the plan. And, you know, there was questions tonight at the meeting that we had that, you know, were interesting from my perspective of her being able to support the plan so fast, but yet having the same questions I had. So, you know, I'm kind of befuddled on that. But I do believe that, you know, in the long-term situation with this, with the new numbers that we'll get from the administration on who might be staying and who might be going when it comes to teachers, because I do believe that we're going to have quite a few teachers who are going to want to leave the district or possibly retire just due to the fact they don't want to go through the hassle of what's going to happen in the school district coming up. And once that happens, then we'll see what goes from there.
I've had conversations with a couple of teachers who have said, you know, it's insanity, and they're contemplating leaving. And I know people who are leaving the profession in general because of all of the attacks that are going on, not just in the Harrisburg area, but in districts across this Commonwealth and across the country. It's not just a local phenomenon. It's something that's going on all across this nation. And that worries me. Who are the people who are going to step in and fill those voids? Are they going to be people who don't have any teaching credentials, but their heart's in the right place, but they just don't? Like, look, I would love to be a teacher. My heart would be in the right place. I wouldn't know what the hell to do. And you know, I can barely keep my three kids in line when I've got them, let alone 30, 40, 50.
Well, I'll share something with you, what I shared tonight with the board and with, you know, the administration and Mr. Vino. I said, it's very difficult for me to be able to say down the road with these cuts, how are we supposed to keep the level of education on the upswing if we're not going to be able to provide the finances
incentive
to make sure that we're competitive,
right,
in the
incentives
workforce.
Sure. So let me ask you last question. The next meeting on this, next public meeting, Wednesday night?
It is Wednesday night. We actually have quite a few meetings coming up, which is going to be good for the public to be able to come out and voice their opinion. Yeah. We have one on Wednesday night, and then we have one on Thursday night, which is a production that's put on by Harrisburg Hope. If anyone just wants to go to harrisburghope.com, that's going to be really open to the public. That'll be much more publicized than the one on Wednesday. The one on Wednesday is an advisory committee meeting
for this.
So that'll be open to the public comment, of course, too.
Good deal.
But I think the better format to ask any real in-depth questions will be through the Harrisburg Hope one. I would advise anyone that wants to come to both. I mean, the more you can come to these meetings, the more you understand about the plan. And, you know, Rick, at this point in time, I can't say that I'm not going to vote for it. But what I can say is that between now and, I think the date that we're really have scheduled for no matter what, that we're going to vote on this is going to be the 20th. We might vote before that. But I have a feeling that by that point in time, the numbers will work out and that I'll probably be going along with the plan, depending on if anything, drastic changes.
Well, I just expect you to give a good look, hard look at it, examine all the goods, the bads, the uglies, all of that stuff, and vote your conscience. Brendan, I appreciate the time. It's always great having you on the program.
Well, thanks for having me, Rick. Thanks, you have a good night.
Harrisburg School Board Member Brendan Murray. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show.
Their rights to be wildcats striking. You know they're going to push us around. Mr. Harlequin Hauler, cause I'm gonna leave it in the ground. Mr. Tap can dig it, Mr. Harlequin Hauler, Mr. Reagan can supervise the crew. And if they find it too hard, they got the National Guard to fix the bayonets and shovel like fools. He's gonna take a lot of longer than 80 short days for this miner to cool on down. Mr. Tap can dig it, Mr. Harlequin Hauler, cause I'm gonna leave it in the ground.
Big doings in Big D. The George W. Bush Presidential Library, Museum, and Institute has opened with elaborate fanfare. And what a piece of work it is. A $250 million, 226,000 square foot edifice on 15 acres. Never has something so large been built to contain something so small, namely the thoughts and record of achievements by this two-term president. His brick and limestone structure is certainly imposing, but once inside, you quickly see that it's a $250 million can of whitewash. Of course, all ex-presidents want libraries that show their good side, and Bush himself was organizer-in-chief of this monumental altar to himself. What's most striking is not what's in it, but what's not. For example, where's that mission accomplished banner that he used as a political prop in May 2003 when he strutted out so fatuously on the deck of the USS Abraham Lincoln wearing a flight suit to pretend like he had won the Iraq War? And how about a video loop of him finally showing up in New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina, cluelessly praising his infamously incompetent emergency management honcho with a now notorious shout out, "Heck of a job, Brownie!" Also, while there are 35 featured videos, a replica of W's Oval Office, narrated presentations by top Bush officials, and even statues of the family dogs, where's Cheney? Shouldn't there be an animated exhibit of the vice in his dark chamber, scheming to shred our Constitution and set up an imperial presidency? Another essential element of George's tenure that goes unportrayed here would be called the Dead Garden of Compassionate Conservatism. This is Jim Hightower saying, why spend $250 million when they could have sent it all with a $25 a gallon can of whitewash?
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
So today, this is the Rick Smith Show.
Interesting story I caught over the weekend from the Chicago Tribune. They did an interview with former Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, who's, I guess, now kind of rethinking the whole Bush v. Gore thing, saying that maybe it was a case we probably shouldn't have gotten involved. Maybe we shouldn't have taken it. And she said, at the end of the day, the Supreme Court probably made the problem worse since Florida had done such a, well, in her words, hadn't done a real good job. And kind of messed it up. And probably the Supreme Court added to the problem at the end of the day by, well, them messing it up. At the end of the day, the vote should be the vote should be the vote, and they should have had to count them, all of them, not just little slivers, but all of them. Interesting now, after all these years, that decision to me, where we are. It was the path we were forced down. Anyway, to find out what's going on in Washington and around the world, I've got Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Victoria, what do you think? Supreme Court should have stayed out of it, maybe?
Yeah, I mean, it's so extraordinary. She says, well, it took the case to Sanders at a time when it was still a big election issue. It turned out the election authorities in Florida hadn't done a real good job there and kind of messed it up. And it was kind of like, didn't you know they were still counting the votes?
No, no, evidently not. She was getting her news from Fox News, evidently. And, you know, for me, I look at this and I remember at the time going, but they're still counting. How could you be hearing this when they're still counting?
It's just unbelievable. And it's like, was she even following the news?
That's a question. I mean, and should she be following the news? I mean, shouldn't you be presented with absolute fact? And shouldn't those questions have been asked? Maybe if Clarence Thomas would have asked a question, something he's not real good at doing, maybe shouldn't that be part of it? And if they were wrong and they lied and didn't present all of the information, shouldn't someone go to jail? Just a thought. I mean, because I look at this one case as, you know, I think law students are going to look at this generations in the future and go, you know, that was pretty much what screwed the country for at least a generation.
It's looking back, it's pretty, so it'll be like when they look at Citizens United.
Well, I mean, you know, Citizens United came about because of that, I believe. I believe all of that push towards that, because you don't get two Supreme Court justices like Alito and Roberts. Doesn't happen. If you have a Gore president, you know.
No, you don't. No, you don't.
And maybe all of that ugliness, maybe all of this pro-corporate stuff, maybe that doesn't happen. Not that Gore was any great liberal hero, but he was not George W. Bush. Maybe we wouldn't have the financial crisis. Maybe we wouldn't have had 9/11. Maybe we would have had a lot of things. Because maybe someone would have read the August 6th presidential daily briefing. Just maybe somebody would have. I wonder if that would be in the Bush Library.
Oh, let's not get carried away.
All right, so what's going on? I see Obama nominated Mayor Anthony Fox from Charlotte as Transportation Secretary.
Yes, he did. And said thank you very much and goodbye to Ray LaHood, the Republican in the cabinet, who I have to say, as a person in the White House briefing room, is the single most effective communicator of Obama administration policies. When he comes to briefing room, I am just delighted. He knows how to explain what is going on. He's good.
Good.
I wish he wasn't leaving.
Yeah, the thing is what I liked about LaHood is he was honest.
Yes.
Yeah, that's something you kind of got to like, right?
Yeah, I wish he wasn't going. Neither did President Bush. We're talking about Bush. President Obama didn't want him to go either. He tried to persuade him to stay, but LaHood's wife had had enough. I mean, he's been with him since day one, virtually.
Yeah.
So she's saying, kind of want to go home now.
You know, I kind of like his assessment, you know, his assessment of where the country's infrastructure is. You know, I got a clip of him. Pretty much giving the assessment.
America's one big pothole right now.
America's one big pothole, he says.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
so what are the thoughts on this new guy? I mean, you know, because I knew people who went to the DNC convention. They said getting around was a nightmare. I know very little about him. I know a little bit about him, but you know, from a transportation point of view, why him? What's the rationale given there?
Well, they're touting his transportation credentials. He's got this light rail thing going on. He's expanded the international airport. You know, he's done some other things transportation-wise in the city. So they're touting his transportation credentials. Obviously, they would. They're saying that jobs are coming back to the city. Things have improved since 2009 when he became mayor. So, you know, they're making him sound like he's going to be able to really do the job. He's only 41.
Wow.
Very young.
Yeah. Well, here's the question then. I mean, great. He's got these credentials. He's done some nice things. What's he going to do with no money? What's he going to do with no infrastructure bill? What's he going to do without the ability to pursue, you know, some of the things that we need transportation-wise? Because, you know, look at ScrewQuester. Look at the thought, oh, we're broke. We don't have the money to invest in that stuff. Let it crumble. What's he going to do?
Well, this is the thing. What is he going to do? Lahood, you know, picks some issues. One of his things, you know, texting while driving, some of these other things, fuel standards, other things like that that he was able to focus on. Is he going to find areas like that that he wants to pick on?
Yeah, my question for him, if I got one, so if you have a chance to question him, where does he stand on cross-border trucking? Where is he going to pursue this pilot program to let Mexican trucks across the border into the U.S.? I'm curious on that.
Yeah, my understanding is that Mexican trucks had another victory last week.
Oh, no, it's going to happen. I mean, the reality is it's on its way. In fact, the pilot program's already allowing some in. The question is how much, and the question is you know, who's going to enforce it?
Right.
Big trouble, in my view, anyway. I see there's some more discussion on the Syrian issue. Did they use chemical weapons? Didn't they? Is there a deadline on figuring this out?
Well, Jay Carney says no, there is not a deadline on figuring this out. What he said today is what I won't do is speculate about how much time might be required to gather the evidence necessary to be able to assess clearly in a way that has been corroborated and reviewed whether or not this red line has been crossed. He's basically saying we've got to do an investigation. Also, today, President Obama and Russian President Vladimir Putin talked on the phone with the U.S. leader, underscoring his concern over Syrian chemical weapons.
And what was his position?
We're against them.
Okay, good. Well, I'm glad to hear Putin's against them. And what's he willing to do with
them? We think the Russians are against them, too, and we're encouraging them to be against them, too.
Yeah, that was my question. Where's Putin stand on this? Because it would be nice if he was against them, and, oh, I don't know, what's he willing to do?
Well, he says he's against them, too, obviously. He says he's against them. Now, whether if some resolution comes up, another resolution of some nature, I don't know what the next resolution would be in the Security Council, whether he would support it along with China, I don't know. So far, his position on Security Council resolutions regarding Syria is mixed.
So let's say they come back and they stall and delay this long enough, and then they realize, well, we knew from the beginning they used them. What's at the end of the road?
Well, if they come back with evidence, and part of that is going to depend on this new team that the UN has just put together, that Ban Ki-moon was saying to Assad today, is you need to let our team in. We're ready to go. We can get there within 24, 48 hours. They can get their team in with access to sites. They believe they can get the evidence, if there's evidence to be got. Chain of custody, things like that, actual real evidence, whether sarin or anything else, in fact, was used.
Right.
Then Obama said on Friday that would be a game changer if a red line has been crossed. They would decide what U.S. policy is going to be. That doesn't necessarily mean missiles are going to be fired. Doesn't necessarily mean there's going to be a military option, but they will decide what the policy is. Now, there are various politicians, particularly Republican politicians, who are saying that you need to be firing missiles, you need to be doing this, that, and the other thing. But then I'm increasingly hearing, I must say, from my talk show host today, some of my more conservative talk show hosts, saying, after they reflect on this, we really don't need to be getting into this.
I'm with you. I'm absolutely with you. That's something I think that region should have to deal with, and I don't want to be getting involved in another one of those things. And, you know, I go back to George Washington. You know, the beauty, stay clear of foreign entanglements.
And it's certainly foreign.
Yeah. Speaking of the Supreme Court earlier, I guess there's a new ruling down?
There are a few rulings today, and I'm trying to find my...
The idea that as a citizen, I have, only as a citizen can I get a Freedom of Information Act or... in my state, I couldn't do it from outside the state.
This is really interesting. There was a California man and a Rhode Island man. And a Rhode Island man had once lived in Virginia, and a California man who collects property records for a commercial client. And they sued after Virginia refused to comply with their request under its freedom of information law based on their citizenship, that they weren't citizens of Virginia. And there was a unanimous court which basically said that provisions of the Constitution meant to ensure that citizens of different states are treated the same in many settings, didn't apply to what he called a non-commercial service whose fixed costs were borne by state taxpayers. Basically, he said much of the information was available in other ways. He said requiring non-citizens to conduct a few minutes of internet research in lieu of using a relatively cumbersome state FOIA process cannot be said to impose any significant burden. Now, there are exceptions for representatives of newspapers and magazines with circulations in Virginia, radio and TV stations that broadcast there. It doesn't address internet publications. But basically, if you're not a resident of Virginia, you can't sue to get information.
So even if you have interests in Virginia, you still can't sue?
No. And these two people did have interests in Virginia.
Interesting. I wonder how the corporate people feel about that.
I don't think they're going to be too crazy about it.
Yeah, interesting. Interesting.
Yeah, it's a really interesting suit.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of those things where you go, this is where we're blocking the path towards government being accountable. And this should be something I'm sure your right-wingers would be going crazy about.
And yet, you know, this is a real case of states' rights.
Absolutely. Wow. Interesting. Also, I see the First Lady has a new program to help veterans. Tell me about it.
Yeah, this is very interesting. Tomorrow, President Obama, Vice President Biden, the First Lady, and Dr. Jill Biden are going to make what the White House is calling a significant employment announcement.
Nice.
For veterans and military spouses. We don't know what that means yet.
I will absolutely look forward to it. You know, maybe an infrastructure plan, maybe some construction, maybe more tax breaks for manufacturers, which I think is a bad idea, but, you know, maybe more of that.
It could be anything. I mean, today Michelle Obama announced a partnership between the military and IT companies in which about 160,000 service members will gain the necessary certifications for 12 high-demand technology professions.
That sounds like a reasonable thing. You know, get some job training. I'm in favor of that.
Yeah.
I'm sure it will come with a substantial amount of tax breaks for the IT companies.
I don't know. The story I had didn't address that aspect of it.
Because, I mean, you know, when you're talking about being, you know, business-friendly, you know, you got to sweeten the pot a little bit. At least that's been my experience. Maybe I'm completely off on this, but generally when that happens, there's some sweetener there at least.
Yes, I don't know whether there is or whether there isn't. Yeah. I can't speak to that.
And finally, did you make it to the press club dinner thing?
I was not able to get to the press club for the extraterrestrial human hearing. This is on alleged existence of extraterrestrial life and its subsequent government cover-up.
We are going to Roswell, New Mexico, just for this whole reason.
Well, I think you should.
We're going.
They're having 5 days of hearings on this.
Wow. I cannot wait to see this.
But you're going. I mean, you may not come back.
We may not, and there are some that are probably hoping we don't.
I mean, it could be. Suppose it's one of those Bermuda Triangles.
You know, here's the thing. I know it's not because my mother. I know that there are aliens because my mother-in-law was born in Roswell, New Mexico.
Ooh.
She may have the rest of the clan not let me come back.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah. So, you know, my wife is kind of interested to go back and see her mother's birthplace. But, yeah, I mean, I want to see the little trinkets and see what they've done with it. And maybe a UFO will come down. So what did the hearing, what was the end of the hearing, I guess?
Well, today's hearing was about the history of UFOs in America. UFOlogist Linda Moulton Howe said that aliens have been visiting Earth since before the dinosaurs. We are dealing with technology so advanced that they can bend space and time, she said to loud applause. Nation of Islam leader Louis Farrakhan and a dozen security guards made an appearance in the PAX forum today.
Of course.
He has previously reported to have been contacted by passengers aboard a UFO.
Of course he has.
Also, there are five ex-congressmen and one former senator who are conducting this hearing. They've each been paid $20,000 to lend credibility to the hearings. One of them is Roscoe Bartlett, a Tea Party Republican from Maryland who served 10 terms in Congress. And he said extraterrestrials are not anti-biblical. Read the book of Job. It's all there.
Nice. Gotta bring it back to religion, don't we?
Gotta.
So maybe God isn't all that. Maybe God's an alien.
Well, yeah.
There you go. Maybe he's not all omnipotent. Maybe he's not all powerful and almighty. Maybe just almighty here. Huh.
It's possible.
It's an interesting thought I had not thought of until this very moment. And thank goodness to the press club for having these hearings.
So it's a recess week for Congress.
You got to have some entertainment. Why not?
Yes.
I guess it's better than some. Although I did see the greatest 15 minutes of my life on television last night.
What?
I was flipping through the channels when we got home from the amusement park, and I happened across a Celebrity All-Star Apprentice, which I have never seen in my life. I never watched it. But I guess I shouldn't say the program was great. Gary Busey was amazing. Anything with live Gary Busey being himself is just gold.
Really?
Here is a guy who is completely Fruit Loops. This guy is completely off its rocker. You know, he was talking about being dead for like 8 minutes. His brain's still going somewhere.
Oh, my God.
Completely flipped out. And it was hysterical to watch. I only watched 15 minutes of it, but that 15 minutes, pure gold.
Oh, my gosh.
Maybe he is one of the lesser aliens.
He could be.
Left behind. Just is what it is. Victoria, it's always great talking with you.
Good talk to you.
Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News. Sir. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Never you will look back again. You fight on to the end. Together we will live on forevermore. In this land we have defended from all things that go.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
It's The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Here's today's headlines from Workers Independent News. I'm Jesse Russell. Sunday was Workers Memorial Day, an annual day intended to reflect on preventable deaths and injuries due to a failure to implement suitable workplace safeguards. While the day is primarily recognized in Canada and the United States, this year there was a heavy focus on the unfolding tragedy in Bangladesh. On Saturday, 23 workers were pulled out of the ruins of a Bangladeshi garment factory that collapsed early last week. An estimated 900 people are still missing, with at least 340 confirmed deaths. The collapse has once again put an international spotlight on the poor working conditions and inefficient building standards in the South Asian country. According to Al Jazeera, police have arrested two engineers who approved the building construction and two owners of New Wave Apparels Limited. Bangladeshi officials told the news agency that the top three floors of the eight-story building were constructed illegally. Workers had protested going to work in the days leading up to the collapse due to cracks appearing in the walls of the factory complex. However, management ordered workers to enter the building and work or else lose wages. The collapse has also brought attention to the reluctance of Western corporations that do business in Bangladesh to enforce safety standards on contractors. In 2011, the National Garment Workers Federation in Bangladesh presented a proposal to retailers that would have helped improve safety standards. According to the Associated Press, those companies rejected the proposals and instead pledged to self-audit. Among the companies rejecting the proposal were H&M, Walmart, and Gap. Since that 2011 proposal was first rejected, incidents at Bangladesh's garment factories have not declined. In November of 2012, a factory fire took the lives of 112 workers. An investigation into that fire revealed that management had locked the doors, so workers couldn't leave, and thereby trapped the workers in the inferno. It had echoes of the 1911 Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire in New York City, which led to reforms in safety standards in the United States. In contrast, While labor organizations in Bangladesh renewed their push for reforms after the 2012 fire, the multinational companies continued to resist. In the 5 months since that deadly fire, the AFL-CIO has documented at least 40 additional incidents in Bangladesh, resulting in at least 9 deaths and more than 600 injuries.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News.
Right now, we're hard at work to bring a major natural gas processing plant to southwestern Pennsylvania. The best argument we can make to the company behind the project is Pennsylvania's embrace of free markets.
One of my favorites. You know, oh, Pennsylvania embraces free markets. You look at all the money that we're handing away, and the latest in the privatization schemes that we're seeing, and the big handouts that we're seeing. You know, it started with the cracker plant that they were going to build there anyway. I mean, there's no one going to tell me that they weren't going to build in that area. It may not have been that exact spot, but they were going to build in that area. $1.7 billion. Over the next 25 years. So think about the governors in the future looking back and going, wow, this Corbett guy who I don't even know who he was, he's really stuck it to us. And now you look at this scheme to privatize the lottery system that we've got. Understand, the lottery system here in this country is, well, it's designed to help seniors. And we hear this a lot. A lot of states, oh, in Ohio, it's for education. In other states, it's, for social services or who knows what. And you look at this whole privatization move. And I ask the question, and I do ask this quite often. Someone show me a privatization scheme that has benefited us, we the people. And no one ever comes up with one. And later when we talk to Mike Consul from the Roosevelt Institute, I'm going to ask that very question of him because, maybe he's got an idea. Because I've yet to find one. And I look at this lottery thing. I mean, the spirit shop, which just blew my mind. If you remember, before we get into the lottery, if you remember the whole argument for the wine and spirit shops, this asset that you and I, the shareholders of the state of the Commonwealth, this asset that we own that pays a pretty good chunk of money in taxes that we don't have to pay. They wanted to hock that off. And originally said, oh, we'll get $2 billion for it. And then real quick, everyone goes, $2 billion? Really? Can you show us any fact on that? Or did you just reach around behind and look to the dark side of the moon and pop out a number? And it turns out they just reached, got a good handful back there and popped out a good number. Like, most made-up facts and made-up numbers off the cuff, just pulled out of the dark side of the moon there, where their heads usually are. So quickly, $2 billion they started walking away from. That was 1.7. Remember the $1.7 billion, and then quickly they kept going down until eventually it became, we have no idea how much money we're going to get out of this. And in fact, if you look to other states, it wasn't going to be hardly anything at all. Then the argument changed from we can get this money to fill our budget gap to core function of government. And you got to love how the Republicans can stop on a dime and change directions and wave that shiny thing. Over here, stupid! It's like the little shiny little watch that puts you to sleep. So then it was core function of government. We don't think that the government should be in the wine and spirit shops. And I got to be honest, you can make the argument one way or the other. But originally you said it was about the money. Now it's about this. Isn't it really just about your ideology and your hatred of anything held by we the people? And the answer to that is absolutely. And the love of profit for a few. So quickly, the people in the Commonwealth said, we don't really want all of the ills that we see in other states that have privatized their liquor operations. And I go back to my hometown of Cleveland, where we were just back home for a little bit, and I walked into a gas station. pumped, and my credit card didn't work in the machine, so I walked into the, that rare I have to do that, but I walked into the station and paid with my credit card there, and hey, there was a, an entire display of a nice cooler with cold, cans of cold beer right there. And yes, I succumbed to that impulse buy, and I bought myself a single solitary can of beer to take back to my hotel room. Question then becomes, is that what we want here in this state? Do we want to have the big display of wine or the big display of 42-proof vodka or whatever like they had in those places? And the answer, to I believe, is no. And quickly, the people said, we don't want that. And, it, and it's kind of died. Understand it's coming back. That whole push to privatize that will be back because they don't have any solutions to solve our job problems. So it's about selling off assets. Whatever it is that we have, we're going to sell off. It's like selling your furniture to pay the rent. That's basically what they're doing. They're selling off everything they can to continue to pay the rent, just so they don't have to bring in more revenue. You want to talk about lazy. You want to talk about shiftless. I think right there is a perfect example of, you want to talk welfare queen, right there. But it just doesn't stop with the wine and spirit shops. Now the next target is privatizing the lottery. And I think Frank Dermody said it best. You know, he said, now when no one in the General Assembly is in session, Governor Corbett is trying to hand deliver a lucrative contract to the lone bidder with no hearings, no legislative approval, and no public scrutiny, he said. And I absolutely agree. The whole thing stinks. Because if you remember, on the 20th of November, Corbett came out and said he was considering a bid, the only bid, from Camelot Global Services PA LLC. The Canadian-based company was the only bidder. They also operate the National Lottery of the United Kingdom. So you could make the argument, well, they know how. I would argue they know how to profit from the lottery system that they operate. And you look at some of the details, and we went through some of them. They said, well, it's gonna level out the money that comes into the state because they're going to have to put up $150 million up front to make sure that, you know, when things dip down, you know, like in 2008 because we had that whole collapse, that there'll be, you know, even funding. And I go, well, couldn't we just take $150 million and put it into a fund and make sure that it's there? Oh, don't talk about that. Don't talk about having a savings, a rainy day. No, we can't possibly do that for ourselves. We need a for-profit company to do it, Rick. Come on, you know better. Yeah. What they didn't tell us in all of this, because, well, the devil is always in the details. What they didn't tell us is that the agreement, this privatization scheme, would require us, we, the citizens of this Commonwealth, to make sure that the operating expenses of the company were paid. That includes salaries, that includes CEO pay, that includes bonuses. That's in addition to their management fee, of course, which cuts into the profit. You know, the understand, when we're talking about lottery profits, we're talking about programs for seniors in this state. Because we believe that the best way to take care of senior citizens in the Commonwealth, and, you know, the good God-fearing Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, the year of the Bible this year, obviously, the best way we take care of those vulnerable folks, the people who are at the end of their lives, who are, you know, just trying to make it to the end, the best way to take it is through gambling. Through people standing in line and buying lottery tickets. And when they don't have the disposable income, I guess grandma just suffers, right? Because we don't think enough to actually do dedicated funding. But under this contract, the guarantee will be that the company, well, that they're well taken care of. Now, as one of the only bidders, because they're really the sole bidder, there were some people who showed interest, but I don't, from the information that I had, there were no other bidders. So, obviously, if you're the only bidder, you're going to lowball where you can. And apparently, according to the House Democrats, they have lowballed their performance targets, which, surprise, surprise, And as years go on, those targets are lower and lower. And the guarantee growth of the lottery over the years gets lower and lower until after 10 years, well, it's 1% growth per year, which it's been much more than that for the last 20. So when you look at this, you go, well, where, Rick, does the rest of that money go? Oh, yeah. Because understand, a private for-profit company is not going to put up $150 million. They're not going to gamble that money to ensure that there's level funding unless they're going to make a ton of money in return. Because one of the things that stuck with me when I interviewed Donna Cooper, who was in the cabinet when Rendell was governor, because there was some talk, and again, I was against it when Rendell was proposing hocking off the turnpike. One of the things that stuck with me from my interview with Donna Cooper was she said, you know, the Wall Street people, the people who were going to do that deal, who were going to lease the turnpike for that 99-year period, what they wanted to ensure, what they wanted the Commonwealth to guarantee, and this just blew my mind because we keep hearing the right talk about, but, Rick, we need to make sure that the low tax rates are lower. We need to make sure that they get tax breaks and there are loopholes for them because they're taking risks, right? I mean, isn't that the argument for people who invest? It's risk-taking. We need to incentivize the risk-takers because if there's no incentive, the risk-takers won't take risks. And if they don't do that, they won't be entrepreneurs. And if there are no entrepreneurs, there are no jobs. Isn't that what they said? Come on. You're right there, right? Well, what Donna Cooper said is in the negotiations when they're talking about leasing the turnpike for 75 years, she said, you know, the people on Wall Street, the financiers, they wanted to be guaranteed profits for those 99 years. And not just profits. The profits, and it goes back to opportunity costs, the profits that they would have otherwise gained in any other investment that they could imagine or where they would have used that money anywhere else, they wanted to guarantee at least that. And I'm going, well, how do people like you and me and how do working people get that kind of a deal? How do I get that kind of, because I'll gladly put up all the money I have to make sure that in 20 and 30 years that I'm going to be guaranteed as much return as I would have done on my best possible deal anywhere else, that the opportunity cost would be actualized. Well, you and I don't get that, obviously. But the big global corporations, the wealth class, does. And who ends up suffering? In this gig, it's going to be the seniors. It's going to be those programs that are funded through this lottery. And what's interesting to me, as the House Democrats point out, Corbett has said that annual profits of the lottery are guaranteed. But it doesn't require Camelot to pay seniors the difference between actual results and its projections. They may pay some of the difference, but it's not going to be all. And according to the report that I saw, in Illinois, where they have a private lottery manager like they're talking about here, the state, their financial penalties for falling short of the projected goal in court because the company that's doing this is challenging the state's ability to do that, even though they agreed to it in the contract. And guess what's going to happen out of that? Well, the state of Illinois is going to have to pay more in legal costs. It's going to cost taxpayers more money. And if this big company can draw that out longer and longer and longer, down the road, there'll be no incentive to hold them accountable. Because, of course, we all do cost-benefit analysis. And if going after the company that's cheating you costs you more money than it would to get what you're going to stop doing it. So, again, you and I, we're the ones who get screwed. And one of my favorite parts of all this is there is an automatic contract extension if the company wants it. So the 20-year stated term could be 30 if the company wants it. No legislative action, no public input, no voice by you and me, no way to hold anyone accountable for up to 30 years. Think about that. This guy, Tom Corbett's going to be out in 2 years. I mark my word. He has done enough. He has been destructive enough to this Commonwealth that I think he's done in 2 years. And he knows it. So we're going to see more of this stuff, which is why we need to be contacting our representatives, which is why we need to be getting involved in stopping this. Because this is a theft, not just from the taxpayers, but from my grandparents, from that generation, and the programs that are supposed to be helping them, since obviously we don't want to fund them. And when we come back, I want to talk a little bit more about this whole this whole lottery scheme anyway, because, you know, the big lottery just came and went. We're going to talk a little bit more. Your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Big doings and big deeds. The George W. Bush Presidential Library, Museum, and Institute has opened with elaborate fanfare. And what a piece of work it is. A $250 million, 226,000 square foot edifice on 15 acres. Never has something so large been built to contain something so small, namely the thoughts and record of achievements by this two-term president. His brick and limestone structure is certainly imposing, but once inside, you quickly see that it's a $250 million can of whitewash. Of course, all ex-presidents want libraries that show their good side, and Bush himself was organizer-in-chief of this monumental altar to, well, to himself. What's most striking is not what's in it, but what's not. For example, where's that mission accomplished banner that he used as a political prop in May 2003 when he strutted out so fatuously on the deck of the USS Abraham Lincoln, wearing a flight suit to pretend like he had won the Iraq War? And how about a video loop of him finally showing up in New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina, cluelessly praising his infamously incompetent emergency management honcho with a now notorious shout-out, "Heck of a job, Brownie!" Also, while there are 35 featured videos, a replica of W's Oval Office, narrated presentations by top Bush officials, and even statues of the family dogs, where's Cheney? Shouldn't there be an animated exhibit of the vice in his dark chamber, scheming to shred our Constitution and set up an imperial presidency? Another essential element of George's tenure that goes unportrayed here would be called the Dead Garden of Compassionate Conservatism. This is Jim Hightower saying, why spend $250 million when they could have sent it all with a $25 a gallon can of whitewash?
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
It was 75 years ago that Capital Blue Cross officially opened for business. From our earliest days, serving our customers has been at the heart of everything we do. Together we've lived history and made history. And we're here to help guide you as we navigate a new era in healthcare together. Explore affordable health insurance options and use our free online tools to search for a provider, look up treatment costs, and more. All at capbluecross.com. Capital Blue Cross, celebrating 75 years of service. Capital Blue Cross is an independent licensee of the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association.
Fox News alert, it's election day, and we got some new video we just showed you of a member of the new Black Panther Party standing guard outside a polling place in Philadelphia. I don't know.
Ah, there's a guy from the new Black Panther Party opening the door for that little old lady. Yeah, wow. Yeah, that didn't make such good, compelling TV, did it, ding-dong? It's amazing to me that they kept running it throughout the day, this angry-looking black guy opening a door for old people. Oh, that, well, I guess in conservative world, that is, well, that's, I don't even know where you go with that. I mean, the reality is they're looking for any way to keep us divided, any way to make the minions that watch that idiocy buy into their frame. You know, that guy who has no power, he's trying to steal the election. That guy who has no real power. Unlike the Senate Majority Leader here in Pennsylvania, a guy named Dominic Pileggi, who, if you remember, not too long ago was one of those folks who, with Corbett, floated the trial balloon on changing how electors were allocated. You know, here in Pennsylvania, which had 20 electoral votes, they wanted to allocate them a little differently, you know, by congressional district. So what you would have seen is out of the 20 electoral votes, 13 of them would have gone to Romney. The other 7 would have gone to Obama, because what they wanted to do is the 18 congressional districts, one elector from each of there, and then the 2 for the Senate's, the statewide races. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Popular vote and understand that's what's coming in 2016. But, you know, here's the thing. You listen to all of this talk on the fiscal mirage. And, you know, in looking at this lottery privatization scheme, Jeff Greenfield at Yahoo News had an interesting thought today. Why not capitalize on lotto fever? Why not set up a taxpayer lottery? I mean, because, and one of the things that bothers me, and I think we hit on this a little bit earlier, one of the things that bothers me with the whole lottery setup, especially when you're talking about funding programs that we believe in, is that there hasn't been an awful lot of research done on what happens to the net proceeds from the $56 billion per year in lottery sales tickets that are supposed to go to education and seniors and you know, all that stuff. We haven't really examined if those are actually... Well, wait a minute. We have, actually. In fact, the folks at the Nelson A. Rockefeller Institute of Government, they found new gambling operations that are intended to pay for normal increases in general state spending. Well, they may actually add to rather than ease state budget imbalances. We have seen over the last several years states like Ohio that their money is supposed to go to education, where education funded has fallen. And there have been numerous studies done that show that states who rely on these lotteries have actually seen their funding go down from states that actually allocate that funding to make sure that it's consistent. So one of my pet peeves is that we're funding granny. We're funding programs that help senior citizens off of gambling, off of people's disposable income habits. But Greenfield points out, he says, you know, people are standing in line, people are spending all this money. He points out, you know, Voltaire, who evidently said, you know, the lottery was a tax on stupidity. And I kind of agree, because, you know, I've never bought a lottery ticket. I don't need that little daily fantasy. I know some people who do. I've got friends who they need that daily fantasy that, oh, you won't see me on Monday if I win. I'll be off on the beach. And then they live in that world where, hey, if I won, and then the next day it's kind of a letdown, they lost. But they were expecting to lose anyway. But what Greenfield says is we need to set up a taxpayer lottery. And how he says to do it, save people the standing in line, because if you saw the lines for the big Powerball recently, people were in line for an hour. And it just blows my mind that, you know, that people are willing to stand in that kind of line to throw money away just for the chance to possibly, maybe under one in a billion, get something. But Greenfield points out, he says, you know what we need to do is we need to have a taxpayer lottery where everyone is automatically eligible. And you make the prizes anywhere from $50 million up to $1 billion. Lump sum, tax-free, you win, you get it. There's no entry fee, no ticket to buy, none of that stuff. All you have to do, and there'll be several hundred winners, there'll be some prizes there. All you have to do is pay your taxes. File your tax return. And, oh, by the way, your tax return will be audited. And understand, everybody's tax return will be audited, and we put the resources into, actually auditing them. Because according to Greenfield, in this country, tax evasion is about a $2 trillion a year business. Not tax avoidance, not the Romney doing the loopholes and the Caymans and all of that. This is actual illegal evasion, the kind that, you know, Al Capone got busted for. Couldn't get him on anything else, got him on tax evasion. That $2 trillion a year, what Greenfield says represents about a federal loss of about $500 billion a year. And he says, you know, you make sure that this happens, and, you know, maybe people will pay their taxes, and maybe you have this game, and it'll be all wonderful. Now, understand, and Greenfield admits, you know, the idea that rich people aren't going to cheat on their taxes and are going to report their incomes honestly is not going to happen. There's very little that you can give them that's going to persuade them because they're already rich. They don't need the $50,000. They don't need, you know, the little bit more that would come. And then you audit them anyway. But he says, you know, hey, you know, we need to, you know, maybe the lottery would be something that would get people interested. But here again, I'm not the gambling type. I'm of the mindset we should be auditing every tax filing. We should be demanding that people pay their share. And we should be making sure that it's not regressive taxes that are destroying our economy. And I look at the lottery system as a regressive tax on the poor. Because those are the folks who generally are the ones buying those lottery tickets or standing in those lines. The working folks of this country. Instead of having a system where the bigger your shoulder, like we used to during the good socialist years of Eisenhower, where the bigger your shoulders, the more you carry. The more that our society has granted upon you, the more that is asked from you. We used to think that way. But things kind of changed. And those changes came with conservatism. This idea that government's bad, and they've really sold the idea. We need small government. I talked to a friend who said, well, I just want small government. I go, I don't. I want effective government. I don't care what size it is. I want it to do its job. And he goes, well, yeah, that too. No. Not that too. That's what I want. I want to make sure the roads are paved. I want to make sure the kids get education. I want to make sure that my grandmother's in a place where she can be taken care of if we can't do it. I want to make sure that our communities are safe. And the sad reality is we're falling down on those jobs because we've got this tax cut fetish. This fetish of enriching the very, very wealthy at the expense of the rest of us. Because the reality is they can pay to have their communities patrolled with private police. They can pay to have their communities paved. They can pay to have private schools. They can pay to have private hospitals. They can pay to have private restaurants and clubs and airports. You name it, they can pay to have separate. And there's no separate but equal. There is separate and, well, you're on your own, brother. And that's what we've allowed to happen. And in fact, the sad reality is because they keep telling us, well, you can be one of us. You just have to work harder while we destroy labor unions and push down the minimum wage. Think about that. Because that's what they've sold us. And sadly, that's what many of us have bought. Let's take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425.
At PSECU, we'd love to help you get the ride you're drawn to. Buy the car you truly want with a loan you can afford. Car, truck, minivan, SUV, scooter, or cycle, new or used, we have a solution for you. Get a rate as low as 1.49 annual percentage rate. Additional rates and terms are available. With PSECU, you can get the ride you truly want.
At PSECU, we've lowered our rates just in time for summer. Get the car you truly want with a 2.99 annual percentage rate. New, used, or simply refinance the car you already have. Choose a payment term of 6 or 7 years, which means more cash in your pocket now. Additional rates and terms are available. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit pseCU.com/life today.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration. Equal opportunity lender.
Earth. Sky.
White dwarfs are the hot, dense remnants of long-dead stars.
They're the stellar cores left behind after a star has exhausted its fuel supply and blown its bulk of gas and dust into space. These exotic objects mark the final stage of evolution for most stars in the universe, including our sun.
White dwarfs are tough to find because they're small. A white dwarf with the mass of our sun would be no bigger than Earth. And as we stand on Earth and look up, we can't see a single white dwarf in the sky with the eye alone. But there are many white dwarfs around us in space.
White dwarfs are born when a star shuts down. A star spends most of its life in a precarious balance between inward pulling gravity and outward pushing gas pressure. The pressure comes from the burning of atomic fuel in the star's interior. As the star ages, it first becomes a red giant, but eventually its outer layers slough off into space, leaving behind the star's core. The exposed core is the newly born white dwarf.
The white dwarf now has before it a long, quiet future. As the trapped heat trickles out, it slowly cools and dims. Eventually, it will become an inert lump of carbon and oxygen floating in space. I'm Jorge Salazar.
And I'm Deborah Bird. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
The man who sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
The rich pay too much taxes. The poor get way too much. Instead of schools, build prisons and lock the children up. We won't believe those lies again. God is a Republican.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, you can download the podcast there at the website or get the Stitcher app on your smartphone. Take the program on the go. You know, this whole fiscal mirage thing that they keep shoving down our throats and all the scary, spooky stuff. Oh, the end of the world's coming because we've created this crisis. You know what the real crisis is? The real crisis is jobs. And you go back today, 1943. President Roosevelt announced the end of the Works Progress Administration. The WPA was started. You know why? Well, it started to get people back to work. And in fact, in the 4-year run, what it did is it created about 8.5 million jobs, put about 8.5 million people to work building roads and bridges and public buildings and all kinds of things that well, sadly, we're still using today that we haven't reinvested and upgraded. I say we need that again. We need that kind of investment. We need that kind of commitment. That's how you fix what ails this country. Getting people. people back to work. And speaking of people back to work, last night we talked about Tricky Ricky Santorum's new gig as the conspiracy theory bloggist over at World Net Daily. Now we see Mittens has found a job. Yes, Mittens has got a board of directors position over at Marriott International. And I learned something today. Evidently, Mittens worked for Marriott International twice before, once from 1993 to 2011. When he went off to run for governor, and then from 2009 to 2011, or I mean 93 to 2002 when he went off to run for governor, and then 2009 to 2011 when he decided that he was going to run for president. Nice little gig, and now he'll be there again. Nice little paycheck, I'm sure, help him afford that subterranean parking garage. What I learned was Romney has been connected to the Marriott dynasty his entire life. And you love to hear those rags to the riches, Mittens pulled himself up because, all that. Turns out, Mittens was actually named after J.W. Marriott because J.W. stands for John Willard. And Willard Mitt Romney, well, Willard. I always wondered where the Willard came from. It came from John Willard Marriott. Turns out, John Willard Marriott was a close personal friend with George Romney, Mitten's father. And I go back to that, that capital thing. That, if you have financial capital or human capital or the secret capital of connections, you're probably going to do all right. I mean, you look at Donald Trump, people say, oh, look at him, he did all this. His father was a pretty powerful guy, too. A lot of connections. That when you're a younger guy, you got the ability to make phone calls. And you look at George W. Bush. Do you think he'd have been anything had his father not been president? I mean, really, stop and think about that for a second. And these are the people who are preaching to us about,
well, those lazy, greedy people. Those people with pensions.
And here at home, we're going to be, here in Pennsylvania, we're going to be arguing about the pension issue. And the right loves to throw out those extremes. There's a guy in New Jersey. A former police chief. He's got a pension of $147,000 a year. And there are other people who have $100,000 pensions. There's a guy in Massachusetts, the former vice chancellor for clinical affairs at the University of Massachusetts Medical School. He's got a pension of $232,000. Is that right? And in New York, there's the guy who's the retired head of the New York Power Authority. One of their he's got a pension of $190,000 a year. And, let's not forget about that guy, because California screwed up, too. There's the guy who was the head of the Modesto City School District. He was their superintendent. He gets $296,000 each and every year. And you go, I see a problem. There's a problem with that. Those handful of instances, sure. And address those. Why are we screwing with people who are making $18,000 to $24,000 a year on pension? That's who the Republicans in this state want to go after. Understand that. This whole push against pensions for public sector workers, they're going to try and divide us using a handful of extremes. And my favorite one, my favorite one is, do you know there are policemen and firefighters in New Jersey that they're going to collect $13.7 million in unused sick time? Do you know that? And I've had that thrown up to me, and I go, well, what the hell has that got to do with pensions? Nothing. But it's a nice diversion, isn't it? It's a nice, hey, someone's getting something that we're not. And my question back to the guy who threw this at me was, well, how much pension time did you have last year?
Well, I had 10 days.
Or how many sick days did you have last year?
I had 10 days.
Could you use them? Well, yeah. I go, well, they didn't. And they were allowed to save them. If you want to change that, change that. But don't conflate it with anything having to do with pensions. We should be defending those people who are going to be losing their pensions and going to get screwed. And just because we in the private sector got screwed, we shouldn't be screwing those in the public sector. We should be going, hey, help us figure out how to get it back. Help us figure out how we get that kind of security. That's the kind of nation we need to return to.
Not, hey, let's tear you apart, but hey, let's build all of us up. And again, if you missed any portion of the program, thericksmithshow.com, the website for the podcast, Stitcher, Stitcher, Stitcher on the smartphone, right back after this with hour two. Stick around.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
For many, the 8-hour day is the standard, but it wasn't always this way. The original American workday was from sunup to sundown, following the demands of an agricultural workday. Over time, the nation became more industrialized and workers moved from individually owned, self-sufficient farms to factories, taking workers from their homes and families. Factory owners demanded the agricultural sunup to sundown workday, forcing workers to toil long hours in grueling conditions. Workers began to collectively organize in pursuit of more time for family, education, and recreation. The cry of 8 hours for work, 8 hours for rest, and 8 hours for what we will grew louder. For a century, the 8-hour day was viewed as the holy grail of the labor movement, and for this hallowed vision, workers sacrificed often with their blood and their lives. The first strike for shorter hours occurred in May of 1791 in the city of Philadelphia, where carpenters protested a day's wages, paying the same in January as was paid for a longer day in July. Chicago in 1886 was home to one of the largest showings of solidarity. Some 80,000 workers turned out to support the 8-hour cause. It was in Chicago's Haymarket Square that a terrorist bomb and the blazing guns of company-paid police cost policemen and numerous workers their lives and their blood. As a result of the Haymarket tragedy, 8 innocent men were tried and convicted for a crime they did not commit. 4 of the men were hung. The Haymarket Square tragedy was but one of many battles in which working men, women, and children shed blood, tears, and flesh in the pursuit of 8 hours for work, 8 hours for rest, and 8 hours for what we will. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
And we have in place today, and young people who are paying into that expect that program to be sound and for them to receive benefits when they reach retirement age, that is just a lie. And I don't care what anyone says. We know that. The American people know that. But more importantly, those 25 and 30-year-olds know that.
Back to hour two of the Rick Smith Show program. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Our quote of the day comes from Honeywell CEO David Cote, who was at the Fix the Debt meeting. He said, quote, chain CPI, raising eligibility age, and means testing should all be on the table. And I got to be honest, I'm glad to see that Senator Bernie Sanders, who is a member of the Senate Budget Committee, is going to be holding a press conference tomorrow at the National Press Club, highlighting the fact, addressing what's going on in these negotiations. Sanders is the founder of defending Social Security Caucus. He has been strongly opposed to Simpson-Bowles, which is kind of what's being rammed down our throats. Recently, authoring a letter to Senate colleagues to oppose that plan. And I'm telling you, pushing Medicare off a few more years, recalculating Social Security and Medicare, stealing, it is what it is. You're basically stealing income from my grandmother under the guise of, we're saving Social Security and Medicare by destroying it. Which is why I've asked Max Rittman. He is president and CEO of the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare, one of the nation's most influential senior advocacy and education groups. Max, thanks for taking time for me.
Well, thank you for inviting me tonight.
You know, I listened to CEO Cody's statement. You know, the chain CPI, the eligibility age, means testing, all that on the table. What does that mean for my grandmother now? What's it mean for me and my kids in the future?
Well, some of those items you mentioned would apply immediately for not just in the future, not, you know, 20 years from now, but immediately. The chain CPI that you mentioned is a really tricky way to impose a smaller cost of living adjustment. And it's a new formula that has been devised that relies on some concepts of what they call it substitution. In other words, if the price of something goes up, rather than factor that into inflation, you pick something that's cheaper. And there are limits to how that could work when it applies to not just Social Security, but veterans benefits, retired federal employees, disabled. But there's a lot of money to be had by doing that over time, because the COLA, as your listeners and you know, is compounded. So it builds on itself.
Yep.
And by the same token, it's a lot of money out of people's pockets that they rely on.
So looking,
this has been gaining some momentum and some traction, and I am deeply concerned about it.
I'm as well. But you know, in looking at the at Boehner's plan that they put out yesterday, the new revenue that they talk about, the $800 billion in closing loopholes, since they didn't tell us what it is, could this be part of it? The hundreds of billions of more in savings that they claim are gonna come from this recalculating, basically stealing from my grandmother. This is all part of what they're talking about, correct?
This is part of the plan. It's called the chain CPI. What bothers so many of us that work in this area is that policymakers that support this device for reducing the COLA, they seem to think that they can sell it to seniors as a more accurate measure of inflation, and they think that somehow that will sell. It won't sell. You know, the last. This year, seniors got a COLA, this current 2012. They're getting a small one next year. But the previous 2 years, there was zero COLA.
Right.
And that's based on a formula that is better. So, in other words, if the formula, this chain CPI that's being talked about had been implemented in the two prior years where there was no COLA, I suppose the advocates of that chain CPI would have said that zero you got was too much.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you look at how they've tied, like Colorado, for instance, has done that with their minimum wage, where they actually took back some of the minimum wage. So I can see their conservatives saying, well, you know, if we're going to do that, we should take some of that Social Security money back. And as you pointed out, harming not just my grandmother, but my future as well.
Absolutely right. You know, the other issue that is, unfortunately, I think it's going to be working its way through this process and has a lot of support, bipartisan support, is extending this payroll tax holiday. And for the last 2 years, there's been a reduction of 2 percentage points on the employee side for the FICA tax. And
right.
That was done temporarily to put money in people's pockets. And we didn't like it. I put out a statement in the first year it was passed and said there's no such thing as a temporary tax holiday, and then sure enough they extended it for another year, and now there's a lot of talk about extending it. Now we need to have things in the tax code that will spur the economy and keep us from sliding back into the recession, but there are other ways to do this. And the reason I was so concerned about it is now coming into a reality. What bothered us was if the payroll tax is cut and general revenues are used to replace it, which has been, thankfully, has happened the last 2 years, general revenues go in, that at some point the argument will be made, well, Social Security is not self-financed anymore. You need general revenues. And sure enough, as part of the Republican proposal, the discussion that came out yesterday, the discussion around it, contradicted those who have argued that the Social Security should not be part of this negotiation. It's self-financed, doesn't add to the deficit. Now the argument is being offered that, in fact, Social Security does count on general revenues, and it needed that general revenue to meet to pay benefits for the last 2 years. That's only because there was a payroll tax holiday.
Right. And I got to be honest with you, though, Max. You know, when the president proposed it and they put it in the law, I thought at the time when we needed it, it was the best, most efficient way to get money into people's pockets. Unlike during the Bush years where where they told us, hey, you're going to get your Bush prize. And they sent out a letter saying, hey, check your mailbox. The Bush prize is coming. And they sent out checks. And one of the most inefficient ways of getting money, from an economy standpoint into people's hands, they pursued politically. It was the best way to do it for Bush and the Republicans because it looked like, hey, we're getting these gifts. And everyone knew they got their Bush prize. But if you look at the polling, most people didn't realize that they had more money in their paychecks when this happened, because this was, I believe, the most efficient way to get money in their pockets. But you're right. It was supposed to sunshine, and it should.
It should. And there really are other ways in the tax code. There's a provision that was talked about last year. I proposed it to the White House, and Republicans did not support it. It's a tax credit, make work pay tax credit, which would put money back into people's pockets right away because your withholding would be reduced. So you'd have more money in your check, but you wouldn't be risking that concept of Social Security being self-financed, should not be part of the discussion now, is not in crisis, is not bankrupt, does not depend on general revenues. And that's where we're at now.
Yeah, I'm with you. I'm with you 100% on that. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're here with Max Rickman, President and CEO of the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare. Their website, ncpssm.org. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Max's name. It'll take you right there. If you looked at the election, Max, up until, you know, the president won re-election, the Republicans were claiming to be the saviors of Medicare. I remember Romney with his whiteboard and his marker showing how he was going to put back $716 billion that the president was stealing. And now I see Senator Bob Corker from Tennessee saying, well, you know what? We're going to have very painful cuts to Medicare. And I see a lot of people saying, well, you know, we got to scale that back now. We got to take money away. Boehner's plan, taking money out of it. You know, who do we buy? I mean, the Republicans pre-election were the saviors. Now post-election, well, we want painful cuts.
Yeah.
What's
going on? You know, I've seen a lot of hypocrisy. And when I've worked on Capitol Hill for 16 years. I was staff director of two different committees in the Senate. And I've seen hypocrisy, but this takes it to a new level. A few weeks ago, as you say, in all these campaigns, not just the presidential, but all around the country, those people who supported and voted for the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare were being hammered with the accusation that $716 billion were being cut for Medicare. In fact, what was done is savings on provider reimbursements were realized, and a lot of those savings went back to improving the Medicare program, adding preventive care with no out-of-pocket cost, extending the solvency of the Medicare program by putting that money back in that was saved for 8 years. So all these attacks, and now all of a sudden, it seems to me most Republicans say we're not going to negotiate unless Medicare is cut.
Yep.
It's just, I tell you, it drives me crazy. It's such rank hypocrisy.
Yeah, and you look at this fiscal mirage is what I've been calling it, because they created it. They can uncreate it. This so-called cliff that they've created for us. They can undo this and do what's rational and sane. But I guess hostage situations and crisis, that sells.
Well, we'll see how all that plays out.
Yeah. So let me ask you a couple of quick bang-bang questions. You know, the changes in the cost of the COLA, the cost of living adjustment, these are cuts to benefits, right?
Absolutely. You're getting less money than you would otherwise. I call it a cut.
Raising the retirement age is a cut in benefits, right?
Absolutely. During your retirement, you're going to get less in benefits. That's a cut.
The Simpson-Bowles plan that they're trying to ram down our throats, this is a cut to Social Security, right?
And Medicare. It would raise the age for Medicare eligibility, institute this chain CPI, reduce the formulas for lowering basic Social Security benefits. So any way, pardon the pun, any way you cut it, it's a cut.
Absolutely. So what do we do about it?
Well, I heard a little bit of your program of all the mobilizing that's going on. We are having a congressional call-in day tomorrow. We've sent, as I mentioned, we have, I don't know if I did, we have 3.5 million members and supporters around the country. We've contacted as many as we could in the last week. And for your listeners, what we've told them is to call our 800 number, 966-1935, the year Social Security became law, and we will connect callers to their congressional office, their senators or their House of Representatives member, and make it clear. The message is hands off, no cuts. Hands off, no cuts. And we will try, we will hopefully flood these switchboards so the message will be loud and clear.
And it's going to have to be. I mean, we've got a senator in this state, Pat Toomey, who he's all in favor of, you know, hey, let's cut, gut, and punish. Let's slash and burn. And it, to me, it's the absolute wrong direction. And for the whole purpose being that they protect the tax cuts for the very, very wealthy, people who don't need it. So we're taking literally, I mean, if you look at the Boehner proposal, we are literally taking food out of the mouths of children and food out of the mouths of seniors to make sure the well-heeled are even more well-heeled.
Well, I don't know how they can go to sleep at night knowing that that's what they're all about, but they seem to be able to.
So, again, the website, ncpssm.org. We've got a link at therickSmithShow.com. Tomorrow's National Call-In Day. Go to the website. More stuff there for you. We'll have some stuff at therickSmithShow.com. Max, I appreciate the time. I appreciate the work you guys do. Thanks so much.
Well, I appreciate you having me on and giving me an opportunity to spread the word.
Anytime.
Max
Rickman, President and CEO of the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare. They are one of the big influential groups in pushing and educating senior groups, saying, look, you know what? Any cutting, any of this whole changing the COLA, raising the retirement age, Simpson Bowles, these are all benefit cuts for working people. It's a bad idea. We should be going after the very wealthy first. First and foremost. Quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Smith Show. It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Here's today's headlines from Workers Independent News. I'm Jesse Russell. Sunday was Workers' Memorial Day, an annual day intended to reflect on preventable deaths and injuries due to a failure to implement suitable workplace safeguards. While the day is primarily recognized in Canada and the United States, this year there was a heavy focus on the unfolding tragedy in Bangladesh. On Saturday, 23 workers were pulled out of the ruins of a Bangladeshi garment factory that collapsed early last week. An estimated 900 people are still missing, with at least 340 confirmed deaths. The collapse has once again put an international spotlight on the poor working conditions and inefficient building standards in the South Asian country. According to Al Jazeera, police have arrested two engineers who approved the building construction and two owners of New Wave Apparels Limited. Bangladeshi officials told the news agency that the top three floors of the eight-story building were constructed illegally. Workers had protested going to work in the days leading up to the collapse due to cracks appearing in the walls of the factory complex. However, management ordered workers to enter the building and work or else lose wages. The collapse has also brought attention to the reluctance of Western corporations that do business in Bangladesh to enforce safety standards on contractors. In 2011, the National Garment Workers Federation in Bangladesh presented a proposal to retailers that would have helped improve safety standards. According to the Associated Press, those companies rejected the proposals and instead pledged to self-audit. Among the companies rejecting the proposal were H&M, Walmart, and Gap. Since that 2011 proposal was first rejected, incidents at Bangladesh's garment factories have not declined. In November of 2012, a factory fire took the lives of 112 workers. An investigation into that fire revealed that management had locked the doors, so workers couldn't leave, and thereby trapped the workers in the inferno. It had echoes of the 1911 Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire in New York City, which led to reforms in safety standards in the United States. In contrast, while labor organizations in Bangladesh renewed their push for reforms after the 2012 fire, the multinational companies continued to resist. In the 5 months since that deadly fire, the AFL-CIO has documented at least 40 additional incidents in Bangladesh, resulting in at least 9 deaths and more than 600 injuries.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News.
Do with destiny. We'll preserve for our children this, the last best hope of man on earth, or we'll sentence them to take the last step into 1,000 years of darkness.
Break. Andy sent me an email. And again, you can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. I do answer all emails personally. Andy says, look, you know, the Republicans have always wanted to destroy Social Security and Medicare. Always. Why should anything be different? Nothing's changed. He says citizens have to realize the Republicans want these social programs eliminated. Always have, always will. Any other rhetoric to the contrary is just propaganda. And I absolutely agree with him. You know, the reality is these are the folks who are against it from the beginning. These are the folks who, and I want you to remember this. Tell your children, I'm telling my kids, that this generation of Republicans were dead set against the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare. Dead set against it. And have worked tirelessly for at least, from the beginning, but at least the last 2 years to do everything they could possibly do to repeal it. And I want my kids to remember that. So in 20 and 30 years, 40 years down the road, when most of us have lost our minds and we're the amnesiac society that we're becoming, that hopefully they'll remember and go, you know what? They were against it much like they were against everything else that benefited working people. Because I'm telling you right now, the genesis of Obamacare, as we move and we're gonna make it better. The tweaks are gonna happen. Things are gonna move in the direction of making it better once people realize, hey, you know, it's here to stay. We better get the best bang for our buck like we did with Medicare. And Medicare to me is the example. It didn't do a whole hell of a lot when it was put into law. And there were a lot of holes, a lot of cracks, a lot of people fell out of it. But you know what? Over time, we fixed it. And we demanded a little bit more. And we demanded to make sure that, you know, granny's taken care of. And we demanded that the most vulnerable through Medicaid taken care of. If only we had thought. If only we had the idea that, you know what? Instead of taking care of the young and the old and the most vulnerable, why not all of us? Why not everyone? And all of us in this big insurance pool. I mean, if you need to use corporate terms, let's do that. One big giant insurance company. And we can have 4 or 5 administrators if you want, but one big pot of money that makes sure everybody gets taken care of when they get sick. Sounds like a decent idea, right? At least something we should consider possibly maybe thinking about trying. Just a thought. Interesting, day in history, today, 1917, the psychiatrist W.H. Rivers presented his report, The Repression of War Experience. This is where the term shell shock came out of after World War I. According to the story at history.com, by the end of World War I, the Army had been forced to deal with 80,000 cases of shell shock. Like I said, termed after in 1917 by a medical officer named Charles Myers, because you had people who were on the front lines exposed to the heavy bombardment, the shelling, and they were completely incapacitated. Debilitating anxiety, nightmares, physical afflictions, you name it, loss of sight and hearing and you know, all kinds of stuff.
And they came up with this idea that, you know what, we need to treat people. The difference was back then, so we need to get people back and get them ready for battle, get them back on the front lines. Sad reality is only 1 out of 5 ever got back and got treated in these hospitals that went back to military action. But today is when they came up with this. And one of the people who was treated for the shell shock, was a poet, a guy named Wilfred Owens, who later wrote of his fellow inmates of Craig Lockhart in England. He said, "These are men whose minds are the dead have ravished. Memory fingers in their hair of murderers, multitudinous murderers they once witnessed." You know, the broken mind. And, you know, I look at this and I remember my childhood. I remember those guys coming back from Vietnam and just being dumped. And, you know, while we have, I think, gotten better from those days, we still have an awful long way to go. And, you know, speaking of shell shock, you know, I say that the Republicans have some measure of election shock. You know, they've been inundated with corporate propaganda, bombarded with focus-tested slogans and hyper-partisan, divisive rhetoric. You know, lies, lies, lies. So I found it interesting. The public polling policy people conducted their first post-election national poll. And what they find, they found that 49% of Republican voters nationally believe that Acorn, remember Acorn back, 2006? Evidently, Acorn stole the 2012 election. Now, they've been defunct for years. Acorn does not exist. But yet, 49% of Republicans, because they're told ad nauseum constantly, it's Acorn who's stealing elections. Right there with the Black Panther guy opening the door for those old people. 49%, which is, you know what's interesting? That's only down 3% from 2008. Understand, Acorn didn't exist in 2008 either, but 52% of Republicans in 2008 believed Acorn, that didn't exist, stole the election for Obama. And again, you go back and you go, never mind the facts, that little fact that they don't exist, never mind that. What you've got is you've got the party of crazy. 49% believe there's this boogeyman out there that doesn't exist. And what I find really kind of funny is there are a quarter of the Republicans in this country who want to secede from the Union. They want their state to leave. And I'm like, well, why don't you just leave? Wouldn't that make it better? And of the poll, 56% want their state to stay in the Union. And then there's the whopping 19% who, I'm not sure. And those are the people that always fascinate me. I'm not sure. Some other funny polling, if you will. Grover Norquist has a 15% favorable rating, still higher than Congress. Kind of makes you wonder about that. He has a 37% negative rating, and 48% of the people don't care either way. 18% of Republicans see him in a positive light. President Obama's his approval ratings have jumped up to 50%, which is, I guess, a good thing. The Simpson Bowl plan, not so much support. In fact, 23% support it, 16% oppose it. And again, the people who don't really have a clue, 60% say they don't care. They don't know either way. Kind of interesting there. My favorite one is the plan put out by Leon Panetta, former Clinton chief of staff and former Montana Republican Senator Conrad Burns. 8% of the people support the Panetta-Burns plan. 17% stand in stark opposition. Interestingly enough, I believe that, you know, and we've had these conversations with number of people. There are those who believe 40% of the American people are stupid. This only proves that 25% are stupid because there is no Panetta-Burns plan. They made it up. It's a mythical thing. Just made it up, just to see if anybody would pay attention or if they would just give opinions about things that they don't know a thing about. And, you know, you think, you know, 25% of the Republicans spewing things that they know nothing about? Oh, yeah, right there. And finally, one of my favorite ones, David Petraeus has a 44% approval, 30% disapproval rating. which I guess, you know, is still better than the Republicans, who have a 38-36 disapproval to approval rating. And look, I approve of David Petraeus. I don't care what he did in the confines of his four walls with Miss Broadwell. That's between him, his wife, and whoever it is that he looks up to the sky or wherever he looks to, between him, his maker, and, well, his family. I'm going to take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. I'm the talk.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Big doings and big D. The George W. Bush Presidential Library, Museum, and Institute has opened with elaborate fanfare. And what a piece of work it is. A $250 million, 226,000 square foot edifice on 15 acres. Never has something so large been built to contain something so small, namely the thoughts and record of achievements by this two-term president. His brick and limestone structure is certainly imposing, but once inside, you quickly see that it's a $250 million can of whitewash. Of course, all ex-presidents want libraries that show their good side, and Bush himself was organizer-in-chief of this monumental altar to, well, to himself. What's most striking is not what's in it, but what's not. For example, where's that mission accomplished banner that he used as a political prop in May 2003 when he strutted out so fatuously on the deck of the USS Abraham Lincoln, wearing a flight suit to pretend like he had won the Iraq War? And how about a video loop of him finally showing up in New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina, cluelessly praising his infamously incompetent emergency management honcho with a now notorious shout-out, "Heck of a job, Brownie!" Also, while there are 35 featured videos, a replica of W's Oval Office, narrated presentations by top Bush officials, and even statues of the family dogs, where's Cheney? Shouldn't there be an animated exhibit of the vice in his dark chamber, scheming to shred our Constitution and set up an imperial presidency? Another essential element of George's tenure that goes unportrayed here would be called the Dead Garden of Compassionate Conservatism. This is Jim Hightower saying, why spend $250 million when they could have said it all with a $25 a gallon can of whitewash?
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
It was 75 years ago that Capital Blue Cross officially opened for business. From our earliest days, serving our customers has been at the heart of everything we do. Together we've lived history and made history. And we're here to help guide you as we navigate a new era in healthcare together. Explore affordable health insurance options and use our free online tools to search for a provider, look up treatment costs, and more. All at capbluecross.com. Capital Blue Cross, celebrating 75 years of service. Capital Blue Cross is an independent licensee the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association.
In a few moments, I will sign the North American Free Trade Act into law. The environmental and labor side agreements negotiated by our administration will make this agreement a force for social progress as well as economic growth.
The anniversary of that's coming up. This weekend, December 8th, I think it's Saturday, 1993, Clinton signed that into law. The NAFTA was supposed to create jobs, was supposed to be prosperous, raise all ships, make everybody happy. Yeah. And now we're talking about the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the free trade agreement of free trade agreements, the end of them. We won't have to worry about it because of the add-on agreement portion of that. That will make that the the permanent. Yeah, good stuff. Good stuff coming down the road. You know, earlier in the program, we talked about privatizing the state's lottery system. And, you know, they wanted to private hawk off the state wine and spirit shops, the turnpike, anything that fire sale, anything we can get rid of, anything that we, the people, we do for ourselves, we should be privatizing it, make sure the very wealthy take their cut, of course. Because evidently we're incapable of doing for ourselves things that need to be done, like police and fire and, you know, trash and all the things that we used to. So the question is there anything out there that has been privatized that's benefited people like me, people like you, society as a whole, who benefits? Which is why I've asked Mike Konzel, fellow with the Roosevelt Institute. He has a new white paper out with New America's Renewing the American Social Contract series. It's titled No Discount, Comparing the Public Option to the Coupon Welfare State. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Mike Konzel's name. It'll take you right there. Mike, thanks for taking time for me.
Thanks for having me on.
So anything that we've privatized, I mean, before we get into your piece, anything that you can think of that we've privatized that's benefited people like me, working folks, I mean, really that being the focus of it that I've benefited from?
I mean, none jumps to mind as being a major driver of prosperity. I mean, when you look at a lot of the privatization, you know, there's been this assumption it would, you know, increase innovation or make things more cost efficient or, you know, give some sort of dividend to taxpayers, but usually what it just means that there's some sort of rent-seeking private middleman who gets between you and the service and gets a cut of it, which is exactly the opposite of what we want to be doing.
So when I look at the Republican plan for Medicare, for instance, this whole voucher thing, we're going to give subsidies, we're going to give vouchers, whatever. To me, again, it's this, as you pointed out in your piece, it's the coupon thing. We're not going to do it for ourselves. We're going to make sure that someone gets a cut of it.
Exactly. When you look at so part of the piece argues that the size of the government is roughly stable among the different political parties. The question is who benefits and who delivers the services. So in a lot of Democrats, especially kind of the more neoliberal centrist Democrats, but crucially when you look at something like the Ryan plan, I mean, the original Ryan plan, we had what? It had privatized Social Security. So instead of the old age pension, which prevents you from starving to death in old age and eating cat food, you know, Wall Street will help you invest and take a huge cut and probably give you the bad stocks they don't want. Or crucially, things like healthcare are something that you run through middlemen. And what the piece argues is that, you know, that is such a default for a lot of the ways policymakers think about these things, especially kind of very serious policymakers. But there's huge problems with the arguments. And there's so many reasons why we want the government to be providing these services directly. It's a better alternative that provides better results.
Yeah, I mean, I think Medicare is the perfect example of it. I mean, the overhead cost, the cost of the executives who run it, the cost to the shareholders, because we don't have to pay out dividends, is less. It just makes sense to me that that money that we would be handing out to the shareholders and to the CEOs and for advertising and all of that other stuff would go into actually taking care of people. That seems to make sense to me.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about the social insurance part of it, so I kind of identify four big reasons why public provisioning is very good. Social insurance is, you know, when we have one risk pool that's the country, it's much easier for us to manage risk. And you look at something like Medicare, it does a lot better job of controlling costs than private health care. Especially when you see something like voucherizing Medicare, you can see private insurers, they're going to take the healthiest people, they're going to take the best subsidies, and they're going to pay out the worst services. They're going to, you know, they're going to try to cream the system, they're going to try to juke the system in such a way that ensures a huge bonus for them. And especially when you talk about things like, you know, the public sector does not have that kind of dividend payout. It doesn't need to manipulate its short-term stock prices to make executives happy. But it also has a public purpose. So if there's innovations, it's much more comfortable for the government to share them, as opposed to, like, proprietary, closed-down third-party systems where a lot of the innovation is just going to – they may even bury innovations if it's necessary.
Yeah, and, you know, I look at the talk around privatizing the state's lottery system here in Pennsylvania. And, you know, all the things they're talking about, you know, doing some different things, offering new games, you know, all of these different things, the state could do for itself. We don't need a for-profit company to come in and take a large portion of the money that would be created by expanding operations and getting more people to buy tickets. We could do that for ourselves if it were good for society and it were good for the rest of the state. We could do that ourselves without having this profit-seeking entity taking money from the programs that benefit seniors. I mean, we can have a whole argument about should we be using the lottery to fund programs for seniors, but, you know, that is what it is. But do we need this private company to help with that?
Exactly. And, you know, when you look at something like private prisons, are kind of the extreme example of this, a lot of times this privatization makes regulation even more important. So you see a lot of conservatives argue, well, you know, privatizing means there's no government regulation, so government's off people's backs. But when you actually look at it, you know, a lot of these government powers are really kind of, you know, they're government powers. So, like, when we imprison someone and let private companies do it, we write them huge books of regulations because we don't want people starving in prison so some executive gets a bonus. But since we're going to dictate the terms of how these things happen, and I'm not familiar exactly with the lottery system, I'm sure there's heavy regulations about under what conditions they can sell to and who they can sell to. Why don't we just do it ourselves if we're going to write all the rules for it?
And that is my point from the beginning, the money that we would be giving to them in profits. Because, look, they're not going to put up a whole ton of money if they didn't know they're not going to make it back. And I go back to what I said earlier. We had Donna Cooper on the program, who I guess is now over at the Center for American Progress. She was in the Rendell administration. And when they were talking about privatizing and leasing off the turnpike, she said that the finance people came in and said they not only want to guarantee that they're going to make a profit, they want guaranteed by the state that they're going to make the same profit they would have made by using that money anywhere else. So the opportunity cost was guaranteed to them, and then they would take over control of the state's turnpike system. And it just blew my mind that they're that brazen and they wield that kind of power.
I mean, that's the exact definition of crony capitalism. I mean, you know, like, the whole point of markets is that you're supposed to have winners and losers, and, you know, the best ideas will rise to the top and so on and so forth. But if the government's going to step in and say, we're just going to make sure that you're a winner with taxpayer dollars, there's better ways to do that. We could just do it ourselves and not have that huge conflict and not essentially be buying off third parties for the ability to provide crucial services for our citizens.
Now, let me ask you this. You know, when Romney and Ryan were running around, especially Ryan running around with his voucher plan, are there any conditions where these vouchers are a good thing? Because when I look at the Medicare voucher thing, I think it's just a horrible idea when you're talking about doing this, giving my grandmother this golden ticket that no one's ever going to cash. Do you see any good in vouchers?
Well, if you think the best idea for how to deal with healthcare costs is to push healthcare costs on old people themselves, then it's a great plan. I mean, that's exactly what it's designed to do. It's, you know, you get so much covered, and this is the whole thing about coupons is that, you know, you spend it, and then if there's any extra cost that goes to you, good luck. You're on your own. That's clearly how it's supposed to contain costs in that way.
But isn't that rationing?
It's rationing through a different mechanism. The problem is it's just a bad system because the government itself can contain these costs much better by ensuring that everyone's in them by using its kind of law, by using its ability to essentially use its purchasing power. I mean, it doesn't use it all the time. It's not obviously using it with prescription drugs under the Bush administration and now under the Obama administration.
Thanks,
but, like,
20,000.
That's ultimately what we want, is the government as the provider here.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And you can thank Billy Townsend for that, the former congressman from Louisiana, who, as soon as he strong-armed that deal through, took that big paying gig with Big Pharma after doing their bidding, which I still think should be illegal. I think he should be behind bars, but that's just a whole other discussion for another day. So let me ask you this. Doesn't this really, Mike, come down to us people, my listeners, people who vote, who say, you know what, at some point there are things that we, the people, can do through our government that is much better than a private for-profit corporation, which is kind of the antithesis of what's been rammed down our throats in the media for the last 30 years?
Exactly. I mean, like, the last 30 years has had this kind of market worship where the market is, you know, exciting and emancipatory and, you know, innovative, and it does all this cool stuff. But now, you know, we're looking at math. What is the market giving us right now? Mass unemployment, huge corporate profits with wages stagnating or declining. You know, a young generation that is, you know, not finding work, an older generation that has huge insecurity with its retirement. And suddenly this market thing seems like not so great, or it seems to have a really bad double-edged sword. And when it comes to providing security, economic security, retirement security, health security, the government suddenly has all these really good advantages that citizens instinctively understand. It's people, like, it's the very serious people in D.C. It is Democrats and Republicans, but especially Republicans, who are still kind of wedded to this market logic, part for crony reasons, because, I mean, those payouts are real when they go get those lobbying jobs, but I think part just because, like, an ideological straitjacket. They just don't know how to they've lost their way to understand how liberalism is supposed to work.
Yeah, and that's a sad thing. You know, but for me, I look at it, and, you know, I have people telling me, you know, Rick, corporations always do things better. They're always much better at efficiency, and there's no waste, fraud, and abuse. And I go, well, obviously, you don't know anything about corporate America.
Right. And, you know, there are things we want basic minimums. I mean, we don't want people eating cat food in old age. We don't want a healthcare system that lets someone die because they can't afford a kidney transplant. We don't, you know, we don't want prisoners being subject to private dividends or, you know, being put in harsher conditions so, like, someone can get a bonus.
Are you sure about that? Are you sure about that?
Well,
I mean, because I got to be honest, I know a lot of people who think those are pretty good ideas. We've got a governor in this state who wants to privatize everything. So I'm kind of, I don't think everyone agrees with you on that.
Well, crucially, I think, you know, there's a saying that Americans are rhetorically conservative but operationally liberal, which means, like, they don't like the idea of it, but at the end of the day, they don't want their friends, they don't want their families, they don't want their communities, they don't want themselves being subject to those conditions. So even though they speak a rhetoric that is very free market, you know, kind of like laissez-faire right-wing free market, at the end of the day, I think the social contract that came out of the New Deal still holds for most people. It is cynical politicians. It is a very small sliver of people who either are ideologically don't want it, or there's a sliver of people who think that they just don't want other people to have it, people they don't like, which is a separate problem.
And that's coming up with our pension fight here soon. You know, and do you see it as I do that? It's all we've been told. It's what we've been spoon-fed for the last 30 years. That, you know, that's the whole message, what you just laid out?
Well, you know, Bill Clinton said it, the era of big government is over. And then, you know, it turns out we had a gigantic Great Depression-sized financial crisis, which would have been Great Depression-level devastation if it wasn't for big government, if it wasn't for food stamps going out and Social Security checks being delivered on time and stimulus and the Federal Reserve. I think... The point right now is to really emphasize, like, these things matter, and they matter for people's lives, and there is no alternative to it. Corporations can't do this work. They're not designed to do it, and they're ultimately not designed to provide basic welfare to people. That's the role of the government here.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. Last question I've got for you, in looking at the fiscal mirage that's coming up, I mean, if you saw the Boehner budget, you know, the we want people dying in the street seems to be it. They want to cut and gut Medicare and Social Security, push those benefits off, make them stingier. They want to take food out of the mouths of children. So that social contract that we talk about, I don't think they see it the same way we do.
It's crazy. I mean, they're out there saying, like, look, cut Social Security, cut health care, so we can keep taxes low on rich people. It's the worst message. And I'm glad it seems like Obama is aware of this and starting to put pressure on it. I mean, I'm assuming you don't get a lot of callers in the radio station super excited about how well their 401k is doing, right?
Yeah.
Social Security is only going to be more important going forward, and preserving that old age pension, preserving that economic security, is going to be crucial in decades ahead. The idea that it would be thrown away over a made-up artificial crisis is insane. It's an indictment of how bad politics has gotten in this situation.
Yeah, it is the fiscal mirage. Mike Counsell, I appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Mike is a fellow with the Roosevelt Institute. You take a look at his new piece, the No Discount, comparing the public option to the coupon welfare state. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Mike Consell's name. It'll take you right there. Quick break. Back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
At PSECU, we'd love to help you get the ride you're drawn to. Buy the car you truly want with a loan you can afford. Car, truck, minivan, SUV, scooter, or cycle, new or used, we have a solution for you. Get a rate as low as 1.49 annual percentage rate. Additional rates and terms are available. With PSECU, you can get the ride you truly want.
At PSECU, we've lowered our rates just in time for summer. Get the car you truly want with a 2.99 annual percentage rate. New, used, or simply refinance the car you already have. Choose a payment term of 6 or 7 years, which means more cash in your pocket now. Additional rates and terms are available. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit pseccu.com/life today.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration. Equal opportunity lender.
Earth. Sky.
White dwarfs are the hot, dense remnants of long-dead stars.
They're the stellar cores left behind after a star has exhausted its fuel supply and blown its bulk of gas and dust into space. These exotic objects mark the final stage of evolution for most stars in the universe, including our sun.
White dwarfs are tough to find because they're small. A white dwarf with the mass of our sun would be no bigger than Earth. And as we stand on Earth and look up, we can't see a single white dwarf in the sky with the eye alone. But there are many white dwarfs around us in space.
White dwarfs are born when a star shuts down. A star spends most of its life in a precarious balance between inward pulling gravity and outward pushing gas pressure. The pressure comes from the burning of atomic fuel in the star's interior. As the star ages, it first becomes a red giant, but eventually its outer layers slough off into space, leaving behind the star's core. The exposed core is the newly born white dwarf.
The white dwarf now has before it a long, quiet future. As the trapped heat trickles out, it slowly cools and dims. Eventually, it will become an inert lump of carbon and oxygen floating in space. I'm Jorge Salazar.
And I'm Deborah Bird. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Look, we know in days like yesterday and today we have a lot of work to do. We got to make sure that we work with our counterparties, our clients, to get the answers they want, and we're pursuing that as we speak. And we're also exploring other alternatives, such as strategic investments or investors and other financing alternatives. So we have work to do, and we're doing it right now.
What exactly does that mean?
What exactly does that mean? It's just a bunch of garble. And same thing with all this privatization. And again, I've yet to find anybody who's come up with a scheme that where this has benefited people like me. And maybe Rich has got an idea. I've got Rich online, too. How you doing tonight, Rich?
Hey, pretty good. How you doing, Rich?
Oh, I can't complain. What's on your mind?
Hey, I live in Ohio, and I'm a truck driver. I drive to York, PA every night.
All righty.
And you was talking about the lottery in your first hour.
Yes, sir.
Well, I was wanting to know why we can't propose a national lottery for, like, Medicare, Social Security, and infrastructure.
Why would we want one?
Well, it would pay for itself on the funding.
Well, the problem with the lottery is the exact problem we had here in Pennsylvania. You had the collapse in 2008, and you saw funding go through the floor. So at times when you actually need to make sure that you have secure funding, like during times of economic crisis, you're not going to have it. I see a huge problem with that. And to me, you know, the whole lottery thing depends on folks having disposable income. And that's a problem, especially now that we've seen wages being destroyed and we've seen, you know, the ability of workers to bargain for those wages being diminished. I'm curious, why would you want a lottery system for that?
Well, because of how these Republicans are, they want to just cut. You know, it affects my mom when they do this.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. And what it should be is you and me and other folks like us getting angry at them and throwing the bums out.
Well, I've tried my part, but it's trying to get the people to understand what their policies are.
Yeah, well, and that's why we have programs like this, and which is why we need to be talking to our friends and neighbors. And look, as this stuff comes up, we got to be talking to people. This,
well, it's just some of them are so diehard Republican, it kills me.
Yeah, it blows my mind that, you know, the very people who are the ones being harmed by the policy that they're advocating are the people fighting for the policy that well, it's just the sad reality is it is what it is, but we've got to keep fighting along.
Yeah, I agree with you. You know, I've taken a pay cut for the last 20 years driving truck.
Oh, I know. You know, the sad reality, I drove a truck for years myself, and, you know, I've got my grandfather's contract from 1976 through 70, or 74 through 79 here on my desk. And in 1979, a truck driver was making $31 an hour in today's dollars. With full health care, eye, dental, and a retirement package, the vacation laid out in this contract, sick days, all of that stuff, and we've allowed this to be stolen from us.
Well, you know, it was Reaganomics that started all this.
Absolutely. But you know, it was beyond that. It was this whole neoliberal agenda, this whole push for deregulation. And it's beyond just Reagan and Republicans. It's a lot of bent-knee corporate Democrats as well. These neoliberals are just as bad.
I agree.
We need to call them out as well and hold them accountable and throw those bums out, too.
Well, I got Representative, Bill Johnson. I've called and called his office, and them people won't return my calls back.
Yeah, I've got a crazy representative myself, but I make sure I call and leave email and send messages.
We were calling when right before the elections, and after the elections was over, you didn't hear from them.
Yeah. It's you know, this is where, you know, I think it's so important, especially as a truck driver, to talk to the other drivers. Because I got to be honest, when I was doing organizing, I was amazed at how many right-wing truck drivers there are who think that all of the negative things that are happening to them are the fault of those liberals. Those liberals are doing all this stuff. You know, the people who brought us labor unions?
Well, you get into some nasty fights over the radio.
I've been there myself. Been there myself, Rich.
I just don't understand the people. They want to have Social Security, but yet they want to take these tax breaks. And, you know, I just can't accept taking tax breaks to have benefits.
Yeah, let me ask you about your you mentioned your grandmother a second ago and how this is going to affect her. You know, what do you see happening to her?
Actually, it's my mother. She's on Social Security now, but they're talking about freezing the
changing the COLA.
Yeah, the income for every year on the increase.
Yep.
And she's only getting like $651 a month. Now that's just tragic, you know.
That's infuriating, is what it is. And what you've got is they're going to freeze the modest, a couple of dollar increase that she would get every year so that we can give hundreds of thousands, if not millions, to the very top of the very wealthy people in this country who don't need it and aren't going to use it to create jobs. To me, that's something to be just absolutely furious about and take to the streets.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I'd rather see us go over the cliff myself.
And I'm hoping the president holds firm on this. Because I think the Republicans lose on that. They created this mirage. They created this crisis, this hostage situation. And just as easy as they created it, they can undo it. So any pain and suffering that happens is because the Republicans in this country want it to happen.
Yeah, it's just like I shake my head that, you know, I'm from Ohio and Boehner has nobody running against you.
Yeah, well, that's in Pennsylvania, too. There are a lot of the representatives because they've drawn these districts that are so badly gerrymandered and so manipulated that nobody really has a chance. I mean, where I live, it's a 60-40 district. A Democrat, the savior himself could come down here and not get elected in that district because what we've done in politics is it's team sport. My team's going to win. Instead of talking about the policies that are going to help your mother and my grandmother and help us as working people, they don't want to do that. It's wave the flag for the team. That's what we want to talk about. But again, you know, it's the wealth class who's put us in this position, and we need to break down those barriers.
See, that's like you was talking about Walmart, and they put a distribution center in my county.
Right.
My county gave them a 10-year freeze on no taxes,
yeah,
which was ridiculous. I voted against it, but the majority wanted them to put the business there to get the economy going.
Yeah, well, I mean, we just gave $1.7 billion to a cracker plant that they were going to build in that location anywhere because, hey, the gas is here. They weren't going anywhere else. I got to take a break right here, Rich. I appreciate the call. Next time you're in town, look us up.
I'm here every night, so I listen to your show every day.
Thanks. I appreciate it. Great talking with you.
Bud.
Take a quick break. Right back with Hour 3. Of course, if you missed any portion of the program, TheRickSmithShow.com. That's where you get the podcast or Stitcher on your smartphone. Back after this.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It is believed that a little hard work is good for the soul. If this is true, then the history of child workers in the United States is a soulful tale. The first child laborers landed in Virginia in the year 1619. These immigrant children found slave working conditions and poverty wages in the New World. As the years passed, little changed. The average child worker toiled 16 to 18 hours per day, 6 days a week in factories and textile mills. Education was a luxury, and many believed a loss on working children. Charles Harding, president of the Merchants Woolen Company, stated, "There is such a thing as too much education for working people sometimes. I have seen cases where young people are spoiled for labor by too much refinement." Labor unions, consumer groups, and parent coalitions all work to shorten hours, ease conditions, and ultimately end exploitative child abuses. Baby strikes in Paterson, New Jersey, and Allentown, Pennsylvania, demanding 11 and 12-hour workdays were fought vehemently by mill and factory owners. The Pennsylvania legislature was the first to consider prohibiting child workers in 1833, and consider is all Pennsylvania did until July of 1903 when Mother Jones led the March of the Mill Children from Philadelphia to Oyster Bay, New York in an attempt to influence President Theodore Roosevelt. In 1836, Massachusetts was the first state to pass a law restricting the use of children in manufacturing. And 102 years later, the United States Supreme Court ruled the Walsh-Healy Act restricting the use of child labor as constitutional. Also in 1938, Congress passed the Fair Labor Standards Act, which put more stringent restrictions on the use of child labor. While hard work teaches discipline, self-reliance, and responsibility, the exploitive nature of our past must remind us that what we have today, we mustn't take for granted, for the days of tomorrow are doomed to repeat if we ignore those lessons hard learned. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Where family values are more than slogans. The Rick Smith Show.
All because the gays are getting married, that is why people die and children go unfed. When I'm sad and alone and I'm wondering just why everything about my life is feeling like it's going down a toilet bowl, it hurts to know it's cause the gays.
Oh yes, blame it on the gays. It's their fault. Everything's their fault. Nothing could possibly be the fault of the wealth class who have sucked all the investable assets out of the, well, you know the drill. I mean, look at the Walton situation. You got four sperm lottery winners. And for those who love the lottery, and I appreciated the call earlier, Rich, I've been thinking about the idea of a lottery. And, you know, the lottery that the wealth class wins is the sperm lottery. And you look at the four sperm lottery winners, Christy Walton, Jim Walton, Rob Walton, and Alice Walton. They have a combined fortune of over $110 billion. That's the kind of winning. And understand, you know, they got it the old-fashioned way. They didn't even have to put a dollar down. They inherited it. And you look at the fact that the corporate profits have never higher, corporate earnings never higher. Wages never lower. In the years we've been tracking this stuff, never lower. And, you know, Rich asked the question, why not have a lottery for infrastructure, a lottery for Medicare, a lottery for Social Security? And the more I think about this, the more I'm against the idea. There could not be a more regressive way of doing it. Because understand who would then end up funding it completely. The wealth class understands return on investment. You don't see many billionaires hitting the lottery, do you? When they do their gambling, they do their gambling on Wall Street, where they pay 15% capital gains on it. When we have a lottery win, it is the highest possible tax rate. You know, that rate that we reserve for the very, very wealthy in this country. And I look at what economist Victor Matheson said. He said, you look at lotteries. They are the worst expected return of just about any gambling you could possibly do. And he estimated that slots paid out about 95 cents on the dollar. So if you were, the more you gamble and the more you go through it, you're going to lose 5%. 95 cents. That's the kind of return you're going to get, the kind of prizes that come back. A good blackjack player could get as much about as 98 cents of the dollar back. Lotteries, in the range of 50 cents, as high as maybe 60 cents. And you look at, you know, the Bloomberg News had this sucker index. They pointed out that the poorer states, states like Georgia, had the highest rates of people spending money, poor people spending money on this lottery, because that's the retirement system. Oh, if we could just win that lottery. And it becomes the addict mentality. If I could just win that lottery, I could retire and I could be like those people. Instead of, you know, squirreling away that buck or $2 or $5 or $10 a week into Social Security or into some type of retirement program, now it's become a lottery. And to do that with our infrastructure, to do that with everything else, would allow the wealth class in this country to completely abandon us. And then they'd say, well, we gave you the lottery. You've got the lottery. Which, again, is my problem with what we've done with programs for seniors in this state. Well, the lottery funds it. Well, is that how we treat that generation? Sorry. The lottery didn't bring in enough revenue this time. You don't get to stay in the nursing home. And I go back and I look at this whole push towards privatization that the right keeps trying to shove down our throat. And it's a horrible failure of an idea. But we've got a governor who doesn't have to go through the legislature, doesn't have to get any public input. We have no say in it. He's going to impose it. Our little dictator, our czar, if you will, he's going to impose it. No hearings, no oversight, no sunshine, no daylight, none of that. He's going to impose it. We're going to give that contract because he can. And I looked at it, you know, during the break. I looked up a couple of things. You know, in 2011, 2012, sales are nearly $3.5 billion, profits of more than $1 billion. Never been higher. Record year. But Camelot, the company that's going to take, they're not guaranteeing that level. Oh, no, no. And understand, for the last year, we've seen profits and the lottery profits go up 10% than they were a year ago. And they're on pace to go for another record year. And you know what? It's been lowballed. So that increase that would have gone, since we've seemed to believe in funding our programs that take care of our most vulnerable through gambling off the backs of workers and especially low-wage workers, where's that money then going to go once we privatize it? Because according to the information that I've got, the bid that
Camelot came up with has front-loaded the profit projections. First few years, you know, pretty good. The last 10 years guarantees only 1% growth. So what happens if we have 10% growth all those years? Who keeps that? Oh, yeah, they do. They get the money. And, oh, by the way, if those last 10 years continues, they get to continue that contract for 10 more years automatically, again, with no input from you or me. Think about 10, 20 years, 30 years down the road. And my favorite part of this whole lottery privatization scheme, and the one that caught my attention, and the one that tells me this is why Tom Corbett is doing this, this is why the Republicans are pushing for it. Because the gaming law of 2004 that was pushed through during the Rendell years, the casinos that we have, they can't make, by rule of law, they can't make political contributions. This has none of that. Camelot and the people that are the benefactors of our lottery winnings and our lottery profits, they'll be able to make extraordinarily generous campaign contributions to the people who delivered them these wild profits. Now, I'm not trying to sound conspiratorial, because we've seen these kind of movies in the past. We've seen these games in the past. And we know the ending. The ending is, sorry, Granny, profits before you. Sorry, that nursing home that used to have a nurse for every 5 or 10 people, now we need a nurse for every 20. And their wages are going to be suppressed, so you're going to have a constant turnover of people doing that job. And we're going to outsource it and privatize it, do all these things to lower the wages and lower the quality of the work and lower the regulations so that, well, we're no longer caring for people in these senior centers and in these nursing homes. We're warehousing them, holding them for their final days, because you know what? Profit was so important. I'm telling you, we need to be outraged about this. We need to be calling our representatives. We need to be losing our minds over this kind of stuff, because we're getting ripped off again. I'm going to take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. If you missed any portion of the program, therickssmithshow.com. That's where you go to get the podcast. Right back after this.
Listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get The Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
The man who sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
At every trough you stop to feed. With your arrogance, your ignorance and greed. Now here come the cuts and redundancy. Through the absolute indifference, the average.